Called me of the Health Policy and Finance Committee to order. Senator Huntley, being the first to arrive, moves approval of the Tuesday, March 21st, Thursday, March 23rd, and Friday, March 24th minutes. Sorry, is there any discussion of the minutes? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. I believe the first two bills up, we do not actually have the bills in our possession. So in order, however, to expedite things and certainly to respect the people who might be testifiers, we're going to proceed hearing them, and then we may have first readings today. We'll sort of sort that out as to whether we're able then to make the actual motions on these. So we're going to begin, first of all, with Representative Severson's bill. And Representative Severson, if you could just sort of take us through this, explain the content of the bill, and then I don't think you'll need to return when the committee actually takes a formal action. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This legislation addresses Representative Severson. This legislation addresses a similar ongoing pursuit that has been before this committee in previous years. The effect is to move the St. Cloud area nursing homes into the metropolitan classification for the purposes of establishing reimbursement rates. Significant parts of Minnesota, the Rochester area, and Moorhead all have received metropolitan designation for the purposes of nursing home rates. The St. Cloud area is more metropolitan in character than many of the areas currently designated metropolitan. It is closer to the Twin Cities area, and the nursing homes are struggling to pay Twin Cities wages rates in order to hire and retain good employees. Mr. Chair, this committee has supported this measure in the past, and I ask for your support again this year to clarify the situation and to put into effect the rate increase. This language is identical to that is included in the governor's supplemental budget. If there are any questions, I have Mr. Borger from St. Cloud area who can answer some of these questions.
I believe that this committee has actually heard this issue. There was some confusion when we passed it a few years ago as to how it would affect. It has not affected the rates as we sort of expected, because it appeared the language itself sort of talked about any increases would be treated in a kind of a new fashion. And, of course, in 2003, there were no changes in rates. So I think this sort of catches up, if I recall, in the governor's budget. And we'll probably quickly pass through that when the governor's budget is reviewed as well. But I want to be sure that persons that had actual bills that related to the governor's budget, everything today they were doing are matters that are in the governor's budget. Representative Huntley, did I sense that you might have had a question or comment?
Comment, Mr. Chair. We've been through this a number of times. The people that work in the St. Cloud area basically are in the same labor market as the Twin Cities. The nurses that work in the hospitals, the HE hospital in St. Cloud, get paid almost exactly the same as Twin Cities nurses. And so it is an identical labor market, and this ought to be approved.
I agree. If there are no further questions, we've had the testimony. I don't think there's a question to the people in that area, because this is an issue that's very familiar to us. But I appreciate Representative Severson, you reviewing this with us this morning. And the committee will take action when we actually have the bill before us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Thank you for the comments. Representative Huntley.
Representative Pepin. And I believe we have a similar situation, a little bit different in that I believe this was presented to the Government Operations Committee. However, the bill itself has not reached our committee yet, so we'll have to operate sort of the same. But Representative Pepin, this again is a matter that's in the governor's proposal. It has to do with the PEEP program. So welcome to your committee, and let's proceed with testimony, and then we'll act on it when the committee actually gets the bill. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm here today with Hal Luderman, who's the Commissioner of the Department of Employee Relations, and I believe that Liz Holding here as well.
Yes, ma'am.
And Liz Holding, Employee Insurance Division Director at DOER, to introduce House File 3625. This bill seeks to improve the Public Employees Insurance Program, or PEEP, which we talked about a bit in here, a voluntary health insurance pool for employees of local units of government. It provides an opportunity for school districts, cities, counties, and other local units of government the option to purchase health insurance for their employees as part of a voluntary pool. The bill seeks to enhance PEEP by containing health care costs while improving quality. This is accomplished through four key points. First, it will make available to local units of government the same innovative benefit design, health care cost containment, and quality improvement initiatives now available to state employees and their families. Second, it establishes new purchasing and health improvement initiatives that enhance the overall performance of the program. Third, it seeks to improve services and service delivery for local units of government. And finally, it further challenges the healthcare market to provide a greater transparency of costs and quality, as well as a greater value for every healthcare dollar spent. The bill also renames PEEP to the Public Buyers Group, or PBG. The new name reflects a stronger focus on providing the use of new purchasing tools and innovations as a prudent buyer of healthcare on behalf of local units of government. I do have an amendment, which we can talk about in a minute, which would request $2.3 million from the Healthcare Access Fund as part of the Governor's Supplemental Budget Recommendation to fund the development and implementation of the program's improvements and changes. The proposed PDD remains a voluntary health insurance pool that must meet its own market performance test in order to attract and retain eligible public employee groups. At this time, I'd like to perhaps turn it over to Commissioner Cal Ludeman to further explain the bill. I don't know if we want to, Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment here. I don't know if you want to handle that now or if you want to wait until after the presentation.
And since we don't have the bill officially in front of us, we're not able to process that at this point, so we'll defer. But okay. I think you've already explained what does is to, I believe, clarify the appropriation, but we'll have to handle that when the bill actually reaches us.
Okay.
But we can proceed with the testimony.
Okay.
Yep. Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you very much. Members of the committee, this Representative Pepin described what this legislation actually does. A couple things I would like to point out. That the what we think is a good insurance program provided for state employees. What when we talk about this being provided for PEEP, this is different than the current PEEP management strategy, which is a customized insurance design for local units of government. Then we price it, and then we they buy it or not. This is two new products, not to be changed, provided through PEEP, priced right according to the pool experience of that local unit of government. As you know, PEEP is a shared pool experience based not only on the experience of the bidding pool, but also the broader pool of which PEEP is. And it is in that pricing arrangement that we think we can offer if we simplify the product design. And this is exactly the same plan design as state employees have, members of the legislative branch and the judicial branch as well. We think we can get this competitively priced for the benefit of the public employees all around the state. The other parts of this legislation I think are important for you to recognize is that this has some managed growth restrictions in it. In other words, it has some breaking ability that we can't, with this amount of appropriation, does not speak to the millions of dollars of reserve that would take tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars of reserve that would be necessary to take on all public employees all at once. And so that is not the intention of PEEP. We're trying to be a competitive force in the marketplace. But to do that, we have to manage the reserve requirements, the underwriting requirements of a good self-insured plan. And so that has its, I want the committee to understand that or recognize that that is part of the new parts of this legislation. Other parts of it also, when you come into PEEP, you have to stay for 3 years. That's a new requirement. Part of the problem of PEEP is that folks that aren't so healthy with a pool will come into the group, and as soon as they get healthy, they'll go somewhere else for the insurance. And so that's a bad insurance plan in the long term. So what we do is trying to restrict and make it harder to leave. We want good customers. We want people to be able to pay for premium or reserve dollars through the premium, and to do that and legitimately price that product for our customers is extremely important, and that's included in this legislation. The other part of it is to make sure that PEEP, whatever PPG is that's now going to be named, does is in conformity with the rest of the market reforms that we're doing with the State Advantage Plan and actually through other private and public alliances. We want to make sure that PPG is along for the ride, so to speak, on the right kind of reforms in quality measures, giving customers the right information and making it as effectively priced as possible. So in essence, Mr. Chairman, that's what this new legislation does.
Commissioner, one question that the committee has had some discussion in PEEP proposals that Representative Abler's carrying has been a matter of how the program is accessed. The existing language talked, I think, about the bargaining unit being sort of the access point, and we've had discussions in terms of if this is expanding, then there certainly are school districts and other places where the method of choosing plans and negotiations are different. And sometimes it's the management side, if you will, that is actually creating some options. If I read it right, it looks as though this retains that that bargaining unit access. Do you comment to that, Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, that's a good point. That language has existed since the existence of PEEP since 1987. I've had recent conversations with Representative Abler earlier this morning, too, about this, Representative Powell, about some of this language. As it functions now, this has not been a problem with PEEP. Obviously, we believe that exclusive reps cannot act quite that unilaterally if there are budget implications to the local unit of government. And so if you look at the 179, the PELRA legislation about the terms and conditions of employment, it just think as a the way of doing business, the employer and the employee are going to have to agree to make this functional. However, that language, it is clear that it is the exclusive representative that can come to PEEP, request a bid, and then trigger that contract. The only offsetting part of it is some of this new language, which gives the commissioner some of the powers to regulate the entry into the PEEP program. So whether that's gives this legislature enough confidence to believe that this will be managed to make sure that both the employer and employee would do this as per a collective bargaining agreement. I think that's the intent all along, that we're not going to force other peoples to pay a bill if they have not yet agreed to do so.
And, Commissioner, the other point, I think you mentioned it, but if you could just one more shot, because I'm not sure I got it. You talked about the what you try to do here to prevent adverse selection, where people that are the sickest stay in this program, and those that are well find probably less expensive options or something. What's the protection that you've built into this?
Well, once they come in, they have to stay for a length of at least a three-year contract.
Okay.
The problem has not been that people are breaking contracts. They're not coming in, signing a contract, and leaving in the middle of the contract. But it'll be for a two-year stay and then go somewhere else. The three-year would be a good extension.
Any discussion, members? Representative Abler? For me? Oh, Representative Huntley?
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, you had talked earlier about offering an HSA with this. Is that in here, or is it that off in the future yet?
Commissioner?
That's under development. It's easier to take the comprehensive state Minnesota Advantage Plan, and we know exactly what that is. It can be priced exactly. But part of this legislation would also allow a Minnesota Advantage tiered product that is also HSA compliant. And some of the pricing and the development of that is still under ongoing.
Commissioner, just to be clear, then you're saying the current language has the compliance in it, just not the actual specifics of a plan. Is
right.
Did I interpret that correctly?
Well, the legislation doesn't even speak to Minnesota Advantage exactly. I mean, it allows us to do that. What PEEP is doing from a management viewpoint is offering the Minnesota Advantage plan and a Minnesota Advantage HSA compliant plan. Those are the two new plans. And I'm just telling you that today, that is the intention of the department.
Commissioner, that would mean that you'd have to have some sort of a high deductible option here.
That's correct.
That's in this language then?
Yes.
Okay. President Huntley, is that sufficient?
Just a comment, though. And while I think this is a really great idea, I'm not thrilled with the source of money, as you might expect.
You probably know, Representative Huntley, that I share some of those reservations. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an ongoing discussion. I just got the fiscal note for my particular meat bill today, and it's clear that the department doesn't understand some of the things I was doing in that. We'll have to talk about that. This is an area that needs to be advanced, though, and meat needs to be improved, and I commend the commissioner and the department for working in this area. I do just want, for the sake of argument or discussion, to list a few of the differences of what passed out of this committee last week and what is in this bill. And one has already been discussed, which is a matter of that who can opt in. And I think we attempted to address that by creating a local study group that would look into insurance matters. And so it'd be people that are kind of well vested in that discussion. I think the department would be well advised to look at that. There's some other things that I think are just interesting to contrast. In the first part of the bill, 225, it talks about that the Dewar Commissioner should be consulted by agencies doing any kind of work on healthcare, which is an interesting position to take. I'm comfortable with the current commissioner doing that. I'm not sure about the future one that I'd want to put in that role. So if Mr. Lindman were going to be continuing for the next 20 years, I would give him veto power over that. But they also are going to develop a new website in this bill, which I don't know why we wouldn't build on MinnesotaHealthInfo.org. And you don't have to react to them. I'm just listing these issues so we can talk about them. This is a time to be frugal and to make the money go as far as you can, especially if we're taking money on healthcare access. In the version we passed out of our committee here, we had an improved labor management committee where they were selected by the people who actually made up those groups, more likely to actually carry some ownership with them of the groups that they're representing, and appointed by the commissioner instead of the governor, which is hopefully trying to depoliticize it to make this actually accomplish the goal. So I urge the department to look at that. I'm concerned about the existing language in this bill that we changed in our bill as an effort to allow a group to bail out of costs go up 50% or more. That's and it had to stay 3 years. That's you might find that would be a non-marketing advantage. We picked 20, which above inflation, which I thought was a good compromise number, but maybe the number's in between there. But I think as you want to woo people to come into this thing, that we have to draw them in and that they have to be, you know, encouraged to come. In our the version we passed out of here, we had a 60-day notice to the insurance plan to retire from the plan instead of 30, which may give some more time to negotiate and make a decision to be made more thoughtful in the part of a leaving group and say, well, why are you going? You know, and maybe get them back in and make some accommodation to them. These are all in House Bill 1862. That was the A-12 amendment that we had. There was one thing that we addressed in our bill, which is not addressed in this bill at all, is the ability of the department to recoup losses. Currently, if a group has a bad experience and their rates go up, instead of staying for their time, they can just break their contract by not paying, and their penalty is they're kicked out, which is a pretty good deal if you're the city or county who's just not going to pay, leaving the survivors with a very high amount of money to pay, which has got this going in the challenge, that which is what gets you there now. There's in the version we passed, we tried to let the commissioner be flexible in allowing him to pool jointly or separately different groups that might come in. Maybe Minneapolis wants to come in and wants their own specific pool, but maybe Black Duck wants to pool with, International Falls along with a bunch of small cities. You might want to create a small cities pool, which would give you some flexibility and might make some sense if people want to join or not join together. Currently, I think they're rated separately as a group. I'm not sure about that, but I want to give them the flexibility. We also spend a little time talking about how you treat a spouse from a group that's left, like a widow, or a group that's discontinued, and here's this spouse, most likely a woman, with who wants to carry her coverage as a tail and still likes the price, and she may have a hard time finding coverage elsewhere, and we addressed that and allowed that, thinking it'd be a very small matter. And then in Article 619, the department is allowed to not withstand any known statute to do whatever they want any old time, and I'm uncomfortable with giving anybody that kind of authority. So that's on the last page. And the question that remains is it a good policy decision to take money out of healthcare access to help teachers and cities get insurance? And that's a policy question that will have to go on. I have an alternate suggestion, which I just thought of this weekend, trying to find a way to get money to fund this thing. And that would be to allow the commissioner and doer or whoever is going to run this thing, if it's those, to borrow money from the state employee reserves to as a loan to fund their own program and pay it back over 10 years, much the same as my original version allowed for a 3% loan to be paid back. At least that way it's a self-contained deal and they can go out and market. One last concern that we addressed in our work in the division, and we did quite a bit of work on this, so and these are all meant to be positive, friendly comments, but it's a hard thing and you want to succeed. is we allow the department to have people triple pay in their first month, up to three times as much in the premium to establish a reserve. Because as you all know, getting new reserves for these new groups is going to be difficult. And the Department of Commerce has actually not approved the AMOM plan and some MIWAs because they couldn't get reserves, and at least this way it addressed the reserve issue. So, Mr. Chair, I've told the Commissioner that I will work with him on this, so I just want to make sure we listed these issues. And Bill's not here anyway, so that's my thoughts. Thank you.
But I think it's fair, though, your comments for the record, and ultimately your bill and this bill will be held over, and I'm hoping that there will be some wisdom here in considering. I think Representative Baper makes some good points in here. So I'm going to need, as a chair, to make a decision ultimately of what I bring back in an omnibus bill. So I would hope that you could work together and give me some advice and then give an opportunity for the rest of the committee to have a chance as well. So I would look forward to that.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, we're meeting Wednesday with Representative Abar. He's made some good comments. In fact, one of them was a voluntary amendment on that 2.26. No big deal, but that shall was... should have never been a shall. I don't want to be the czar of health care. That was a may consult with. And that was to incorporate whatever we do with the rest of the world. And so that was amendment was already on its way. And some of those other ideas are, some of them are legally entangled with CGIP trust funds and stuff like that, but we can talk that through. We'll find a way.
Okay. Any further discussions? Person of Paul.
Looking at the amendment, and at the bill, and it appears that the amendment language is already appears in the bill.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, it was amended out in the Health Care Access Fund language?
Yes.
That was amended out in the Governmental Operations Committee. It was in the original bill, yes.
We have original bill language before us. So.
I see. Very good. Thank you.
And... Even though we might question, the bill is a little lacking in wholeness at this point, so we need to put something back in there. But we don't have the bill before, so we'll have to do that later today, hopefully. I suggest, members, that this bill and the Severson bill that you put back in your folders so that when we do get back to actually take committee action on it, that you have it. Representative Pepin?
Mr. Chair, I also have Scott Kernkins from the Association of Metropolitan School Districts who wanted to testify in favor of the bill. Is this the appropriate time, or do you
want
to?
Yes, it would. Yep. Welcome to committee. To begin by introducing yourself again.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and I'll be very brief since I have a busy schedule, but we do want to go on record in support of the bill, of House File 3625. I want to thank Representative Pepin for bringing this forward, and really want to thank Commissioner Ludeman, who has been very accommodating, come out and has spoken with our groups, our education groups, and in fact just had a briefing last Friday, and the reception was very positive from our board members, our superintendents, our human service representatives, human resource managers, excuse me, who think that this concept has the potential to be a tremendous benefit to school districts. And so we're hopeful that Representative Pepin and Representative Abler and the committee can come together to resolve some of those issues that you've just discussed and move this forward. I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chairman, and thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
I do have one other person that wanted to testify.
Certainly.
Quickly. Lee Johansson from Education Minnesota.
Johansson, welcome to the committee.
My name is Lee Johansson with Education Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before the committee today and again to congratulate the department and Representative Pepin on addressing a much-needed reform of the public employees insurance plan. We at Education Minnesota support this, but we do want to point out that while it is a needed reform for the public employees group, it does not address the comprehensive insurance reform that we believe is necessary for school employees. And so while it's a good step forward, there is still much work to be done. But in that sense, we stand ready to work with anybody who is wanting to work with this bill in order to make sure it's the best bill possible.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johansson, it appears that this does address what your membership, at least some of your membership, has been asking for, and that it will allow schools better access to this type of pooling option. I'm not sure I understand when you say that it's not nearly comprehensive enough. Could you explain that to me in more detail, Mr. Johansson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, it is our belief that in order for meaningful, comprehensive reform to provide insurance on something other than a crisis situation, that we have to have stability or coherence in the pool. And while we take a step forward by increasing the number of years of commitment from 2 to 3, we still believe that the history of voluntary pools creates volatility and instability, and ultimately will lead to a death spiral that will not meet the needs of the larger group. And so we believe we have to create a pool that has considerably more coherence of that large pool in order to stabilize rates.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johansson, just so I'm clear then, that it's not a matter of being comprehensive. Maybe that's the wrong word. It's a matter of making sure that it's that there are no options, that there is one mandatory option is what you're talking about. Is that correct, Mr. Johansson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, we're on record as being in favor of a mandatory pool for all school employees. We are further on record as saying what we want to do is support legislation that has long-term comprehensive capabilities of succeeding. We have looked at and will continue to look at and work with anybody who can move in that direction. So when you say one solution, no, we don't believe there's one solution. We're willing to work with any group to achieve a solution. However, it has to create stability, and we have to fashion something to offer the greatest possible stability, and we think there's room to move in that. We aren't rejecting anything along the way, you know, without seeing it.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that wishes to testify regarding this bill? I see no one. Representative Woodman.
Mr. Woodman. Used to be.
Sorry.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, if it would help to precondition some of the debate about the Health Care Access Fund, I think I need to remind even the members of this committee that we are reaching the point where some school districts are actually dropping health coverage, health insurance coverage. So I don't know if we have to review, and I'm sure this committee is probably better versed in the intended use and the statutory use of the Health Care Access Fund. But short of some of the reforms talked about in this legislation or other more global proposals, there will be more Minnesotans without health insurance or access to it should this not go forward. So I'm just trying to precondition some of the debate about the appropriate use for that Health Care Access Fund. I know it competes with some much more large, bigger uses, more global uses for that Health Care Access Fund. This one is on the road. This is about health insurance and health care accessibility.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to, you know, pile on some commendations here. This is exactly the way we have to go if we're going to keep people in groups. I just have one question for Representative again. Commissioner Ludeman, whoever you are there. Tell me again how you plan to build your reserves, please.
Commissioner Ludeman?
Well, Mr. Chairman, first of all, we have reserves today in a relatively small pool. The appropriation, some of this appropriation would be used for marketing, development, and much of this pricing. If you remember in this legislation, every 4 years, PPG will be required to give a competitive bid to every school district in the state, staged based on the expiration of their collective bargaining agreements. So some of the money is used there. Any money not spent for all that would be in the reserve. The rest of the reserves, the real reserves, would be simply built into the premiums charged to the customers. So the Blaine School District would purchase insurance product through PPG, and within those premiums would be built a reserving or underwriting rate.
Right. Mr. Chair, just so you know, and that's the same concern I have with the state mandatory health plan too. So it's We'll talk about it some more.
It's a
hard thing to build reserves. Reserves are very expensive. You start adding up what it costs. $1 million, $10 million, I discovered in my work, doesn't go anywhere. It's like 1,000 or 1,500 people in it. So it's really hard, Mr. Chair.
Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would agree with the Commissioner that this use of the Health Care Access Fund at least makes me think about it.
Okay.
there will be some proposals up shortly that I would say definitely ought to be general fund obligations. But this one is, I can understand that it should be debated.
I think you're correct. At least it's in the field of helping people have insurance. I see no further testimony or discussion. We will return to action on the bill when we have the bill before us. So thank you, Representative Pepin. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you for being here just in case.
The next bill on our calendar is House File 3697. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to just get matters in order so that we have the right language before us. We've been sort of catching up a bit with some language that was lost in revisers. So first I'll move House File 3697 for possible inclusion. And then I would like to move the AO6-1279 delete all. This picks up that language that was missing in the original draft of the bill. I'm going to have another amendment to do some technical corrections, but all of this is just to get before the committee the language that we'll be talking about today, and we'll largely be doing that by walking through the budget book itself. But I would appreciate passage of Amendment AO6-1279.
Very good. Representative Bradley moves that House File 3697 be recommended to pass and be included in the omnibus bill. He further moves that the AO6-1279 lead-all amendment be moved.
That would be adopted, yeah.
Be adopted. Does everybody understand the motion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
And then, Mr. Chair, members, I would move the A2 amendment. I'm told that these are just sort of technical corrections corrections to the languages in the delete all that we just adopted.
Very good. Representative Bradley moves the A2 amendment. Any questions to that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion carries.
Two ayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, what I would like to do, and I believe that we'll probably be referring to the budget books which members have before them, is to ask the three agencies involved, and we'll have the Veterans Home Board come up first and review the proposals that are part of the governor's budget first, and then we'll do the Department of Health, and then finally do the Department of Human Services.
Okay, Mr. Chairman. Testifiers. Settle themselves and introduce themselves.
Mr. Chair, I'm Robert Erickson. I'm a member of the Board of the Veterans Home.
Welcome to the committee.
And I'm here to introduce Steve Musser, our Executive Director, and Doug Rickenbaugh, who are going to be making the presentation. Steve, are you going to start off with that?
Members, in your folders, it's the back tab under the heading Vets Home Board. Follow along from there.
Mr. Chair, my name is Steve Musser. I'm the Executive Director of the Veterans Homes Board. With me is Doug Rickbaugh. Doug will begin our presentation on our supplemental budget request.
Mr. Chair, my name is Doug Rickabaugh. I'm the financial director for the Minnesota Veterans Homes Board. We're going to begin on page 4 of the supplement, which gives a background of where our projections were as in the fall of 2004. The bottom line here, we projected $920,000 we would have a balance at the end of the current biennium at that time. Starting out, we had a reserve, a 10-year accumulation of $6,641,000. Legislative appropriation was $60,060,000. Our funding from VA per diems was estimated at $27,754,000. We expected to get $32,867,000 from resident payments. So the total funds available projected was $127,322,000. Our budgeted expenditures were $126,402,000, leaving the $920,000 balance. What happened? We had a decrease in census at Silver Bay and Hastings. We had an increase in the number of spouses at our homes, which resulted in a loss of VA per diems. Revenue growth of 2.5% did not occur. It was reduced to zero. We had the Minneapolis Health Survey in July 2005, which resulted in us adding additional staff at Minneapolis to meet acuity levels needs for the residents there. We developed a response to the health dimension recommendations, and we've had a 50% increase in our energy costs. If you skip ahead to slide 8, this is what resulted in our current request of $12,677,000 for this biennium. Summary of the changes, wage and benefit settlements, $980,000. Our Minneapolis resident care staff was increased by 42 nursing positions for $4,027,000. We implemented some immediate corrective actions before the study came out, $1,095,000. The study recommendations themselves added 15 and a half more positions for $1,351,000. We proposed to restore our repair and betterment, which had been zeroed out, to $2,380,000, the previous level. Energy costs, as I mentioned, went up 50%, $870,000. Our revenue declined to $1,868,000, and we're proposing our reserve be moved back up to our level of $2 million. And for time purposes, if we skipped ahead to chart 13, this is just a pie chart of what was on the previous slide showing the types of requests that we made, are making.
And then, Mr. Chairman, just to summarize, our supplemental budget request is $12.6 million. The governor recommended $7.426 for the agency, and that included the health dimension study recommendations, adjustment for a revenue decline, and then the Minneapolis nursing adjustments. And not recommended in that was a reserve for contingencies, the restoration of our repair and betterment funds, and our energy costs. There are some consequences that may occur if we don't get full funding of our budget request. This leaves us without a reserve. since 50% of our costs are from state appropriation, we have some volatility with the per diems and some of our revenue sources, our patient pay sources, and these fluctuations do occur from time to time, and we wouldn't be able to respond to these if that did happen without a reserve. It also may require a moratorium on new admissions if we have to look for money to fund things like our fuel increases. Could potentially cause us to close some beds or eliminate some special programs. Without any repair and betterment funds, some of the deferred maintenance may be deferred further, and we may in fact need to use some of our existing dollars in case things really need to be done, and that would cause us some additional difficulty. And finally, we have seen an increase in the number of spouses that we serve at our homes. We can serve up to 25% in our homes, and as that number increases, that takes away any VA per diems that we have. So we may have to investigate the possibility of reducing the number of spouses that we serve. Now, of course, it's not good to come and ask for money without recommending where that money might come from. We just received a grant reimbursement from the VA for $12.9 million. $2.2 million was included in last year's bonding bill that we can use for asset preservation. However, $10.7 million is now moving to the general fund. We suggest that the bulk of this supplemental request be absorbed by the grant reimbursement that we sought from the VA, really leaving our net request at $1.9 million. Bob?
Thank you, Steve. Mr. Chair, I neglected to introduce one of our other board members who's here. Dean Ashman is here also, and thank you very much for taking the time to hear us. This is a real serious issue for us, and we obviously appreciated very much the governor's supplemental recommendation. But in my best judgment, unless we get at least several million dollars more, we're going to be in a very difficult situation of having to either start to reduce some of the services that our executive director mentioned, or else be back here again next year asking for another supplemental recommendation. As we currently have the numbers and as we're looking at them, we're going to be in a situation where the fuel costs, I think, are real dollars that we have to pay out. Also, in my judgment, and we've asked our staff to go through and reprioritize the repair and betterment listing, but in my judgment, at least half of that listing is something that's not optional. It's something that we recited in terms of the Department of Health survey for items relating to TIF payments and other things like that. And I think the other thing that I have increasingly tried to do is I've been on a Veterans Homes Board, is to put myself in the shoes of our residents. These people are there 24/7, and so the physical appearances and things are very, very important. And so I think that we're in a situation where I would consider many of these things not to be cosmetic, but really truly quality of life issues. So we would very much like you to consider, if you could, giving us the full request. But if push comes to shove, I guess we can operate without the contingency. That doesn't mean that we're... It's a very prudent situation to be in. And I would remind you, as you all know, these are all budgeted numbers, and so they can go up and down. And unfortunately, as the review showed you, there are a number of these things that have gone down and not up. Now, we're hopeful maybe there will be some things that will come our way, but to be asked to operate where we really have nothing in reserve is a very, very difficult situation. So we would ask for strong consideration for an increase over the governor's recommendation. We would very much like to have the full request of the $12.6 million. But at least several million dollars more is going to be necessary, in my judgment, or we're going to have a very difficult situation of having to either shut some of these things down, probably within 6 months, start that whole process going through, or else have to be back asking for more funds. Thank you very much.
Mr. Erickson, on the repair and betterments, did any of that appear in your bonding request?
Mr. Chair, I can speak first, then I can ask Doug and Steve to clarify. Most of the, all of the items in the repair and betterment list did not, were not included in the capital funding bill. As we all know, there's kind of a gray area where some of these things can kind of be combined, but those particular items have not. But that's part of the process that we want to be going through and looking at it. And I came up with my roughly $1 million off the bat and envelope from looking through the list that Steve had given me and tried to just look at the items that I thought were fire life safety and some of these issues relating to quality of life issues for our residents.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Mr. Rickabout, go ahead.
None of the items on the repair and betterment list are bondable.
That basically was my question. These are, I think I heard chip paint. This is more that type. You're not talking about new roofs or anything like that.
Correct.
Very good. Further testimony?
Yeah, the distinction that we draw between asset preservation and repair and betterment, under asset preservation, you may repave a parking lot, but under repair and betterment, you may reseal the parking lot, and there is certainly a major difference in that.
Any questions from the committee? Representative Samuelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Anybody can address this. If you would have to start eliminating some services or readjusting, where would you start?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Samuelson, you know, really depends on the magnitude of the numbers. Unfortunately, you can't just close a few beds and have any kind of meaningful financial gain. We would have to start to look at closing units at a particular facility. The difficulty comes in because every dollar we might recoup, it really costs us two because of the way our revenue sources come. And so we end up having to close twice as many beds to earn that $1 back.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Trembo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This seems like a scary, slippery slope. We have more soldiers than ever coming up through the ranks, and to watch this erode, do you think there's a chance that, well, hopefully we can fund this stuff, but where is this going? Is this a first step in eliminating veterans' homes and things like that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, hopefully that's not the case. We have been in a situation where there has been some debate at the federal level about which priorities they're going to fund. We're fortunately in a situation now where apparently that's off the table, at least right for now. We are looking at possibly a little bit better reimbursement rates, although that has to work through the process, and that could help a little bit, although it's not going to be anywhere near enough to take and fill the gap that I was talking about. I would just, you know, say to you and to share your feelings that I've been on the board now about a year and a half. I'm a veteran of the Vietnam era, and I happen to have one of my classmates from high school that is in the Hastings home in the Nola Pillory area, and it's something that I think is critically important that we do take and support people that have given so generously of themselves and their service, and it is a particular concern when we look at the Iraq situation and we look at the severity of the wounds and also the mental issues that I think we're going to be dealing with this issue for a long period of time. So we on the board, we take this very, very seriously in terms of looking at it, and we had had a situation where there was a fairly substantial reserve, but that has been pulled down now, And so it's really scary to be looking at operating without really having any ability to meet contingencies and things, which we know will happen.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, we cheer on the soldiers when they go to war, but when they retire, it looks like something different.
Representative Bradley.
Chair, I do need to react at least in some part to that. If you look at historically in bonding, the state of Minnesota has made significant investments in veterans' homes. If you look at operational expenses as well, even the governor has, in a non-budget year, is putting quite a bit of money. Over $7 million in a non-budget year, I think, is a significant investment. So I do think that the state of Minnesota has made a really significant investment. Those of you who have been around when we've done the Silver Bay work, when we did a lot of rework at Laverne, Hastings projects, we just got a nice check from the federal level in terms of the, I believe it was both Silver Bay and Hastings projects as well. So I certainly don't want the public to have any kind of image that we're in any kind of going out of business sale. We've been making substantial investments. There will always be stress in terms of more investments on top of that, but there has been considerable investments made.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Bradley, you have any other comments?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. I want to try to reconcile the language in the delete all that we just passed does include the governor's recommendations. I want to be clear, however, at least at this point, this is the first that I've seen that there are additional requests, and I don't know that we have any place, so we may need to work with the veterans to get this appropriately for consideration. And you know, I'll consider from the chair's point of view, it's before us, whether it's bill or not form, that these additional requests are certainly part of what we would have. So it's a little unusual since we don't really have a bill or any place that keeps us when we make our motion. As far as for possible consideration, technically, it doesn't include these items. And that may be something that the board wants to think about, whether these should be included in some kind of way to give more formal process. I mean, I consider them as a part of it, but from our formal committee process, I don't have a vehicle at this point. A presentation is not typically a vehicle that we would have, so you may want to consider whether there's some way of these additional requests being included or documented or bill put in bill form or an amendment or something as a way to make sure that those are legitimately considered. That's the only point I would make, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Who'd you like to have up next?
We'll have the health department area.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Gentlemen, thank you for your testimony. I'll call the health department up.
Good morning, members of the committee. Thank you for the invitation to come before the committee today to talk about the governor's supplemental budget proposals for the Department of Health. For the record,
Commissioner, introduce yourself, please, for the tape.
My name is Linda Boudreau, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health. With me is Margaret Kelly, who is our Chief Financial Officer. Commissioner Mandernach had intended to be here today to present the governor's supplemental budget herself, but she sends her greetings and appreciation for the opportunity to present before you and apologizes for her inability to be here. The Department of Health has three supplemental budget proposals and requests: pandemic influenza preparedness, electronic health technology, and immigrant health initiatives. Pandemic influenza preparedness is a $10.5 million proposal over the next 3 years to improve the state's capacity to effectively and quickly respond to a pandemic. I would like to take a few minutes to talk about why this is so important to Minnesotans. Is Commissioner Campion here today? He is not here yet, but he has been here to help with this proposal. As you know, Commissioner Campion from the Department of Public Safety oversees the Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. So I just want to mention that he is also part of this initiative. Pandemic influenza is not just a health issue. It's an issue for every employer, school, healthcare facility, community, and family in Minnesota. Currently, there is great concern around avian flu. Let me give you some facts. It is a pandemic in the bird population. There are several handouts that are being distributed, and I will go through those with you, one of which has a world map that depicts the spread of the virus to date. It's a colored map, and the gold areas shows you where H5N1 has been detected in wild birds and where it has been detected in poultry and wild birds. There have been only a few cases where the disease has been transmitted to other species. As of yesterday, there have been 186 confirmed cases of the virus in humans worldwide and 105 deaths. It is predicted to show up in the United States bird population by the fall. Our role, and I mean yours and mine, is to focus on the preparation for the mutation of the disease when it begins to spread from birds to humans. A severe pandemic would be a catastrophe. It would not be limited to a single state, region, or country. It would be worldwide. It will move quickly. It will spread around the world in about 6 to 8 weeks. Also in your handouts is a series of U.S. maps. If you turn to the second page of the handout, these maps depict the spread of the 1918 influenza pandemic. Please keep in mind that in 1918, we were not traveling around the world or across the country the way we are today. The very first page is the beginning of the pandemic before September 14th. And as you can see, there are very little signs of breakouts or outbreaks from the pandemic. If you look to the second page, which says between September 14th and 21st, that is the first week. The shaded areas represent the geographical point where the outbreaks occurred. On the second week, as the outbreaks are spreading between September 21st to the 28th. And then on the third week, you can see the widespread outbreaks of the disease. And after October 1st is pretty much an illustration of how the pandemic 88 years ago, how it came quickly, how it was widespread, and how those outbreaks had occurred. We estimate that 30% of the population could become ill. In Minnesota, that would be 1.5 million people, and that could result in about 170,000 hospitalizations, could result in as many as 30,000 deaths. Currently, we anticipate about 36,000 deaths a year that occur. A plan to deal with potential deaths would be part of pandemic planning, of course. Our proposal would put us in a position to prepare for the potential of a pandemic. Some of you may say that a pandemic may never happen. You could be right. I certainly hope so. If a pandemic does occur, we will not have spent enough time or money in preparation, no matter how large the effort. The last handout page depicts the effect that planning could have on a pandemic. The red and the blue lines give you an illustration of how, with no interventions, the first wave and the impact with interventions, as you can see, the delay is onset as well as the impact of the pandemic is lessened. That's the purpose of our proposal here today. We will lessen its impact. Significantly fewer people will become sick, and subsequently fewer people will die. Our proposal would put resources in key areas. Planning and testing our systems, the first area, is necessary to practice our response exercises statewide. Second area is early detection and tracking the disease, which allows us to follow the changes and the spreads of the illness as it spreads. The third area would be preparing our healthcare system to respond, which is an enormous challenge as we do not have enough hospital beds in this state to handle the number of people who could become ill. Currently, we have about 16,000 licensed hospital beds, with about 8,000 of them staffed and filled. As I mentioned, it is estimated that we could need 170,000. Preparing our communities to respond is important because the response to a pandemic will be local. Businesses, schools, and local government, having them prepared is key. Another area is the coordination of our statewide efforts. This is dependent on state guidance. The response to a pandemic will be local, but local units of government will be looking to us for guidance and direction, and we cannot let them down. I'm not sure, Mr. Chairman, if you would like me to continue with all three of our initiatives or if you'd like questions after each one. I've reached the conclusion of the initial presentation on the pandemic proposal, and we have folks here that can answer questions.
Sure. Why don't we do that? Are there any questions from the committee concerning this part of the testimony? Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, you said we have 16,000 in the hospital beds staffed right now, and you're looking at 172,000 hospitalizations. Obviously, we don't have enough beds. We're going to have to find some place to put those folks. And in addition to that, we won't have near enough respirators to deal with these people. Is there something in this $31,500,000 over the next 3 years that's going to do something for respirators and increase hospital beds?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative
Huntley, this is all part of the planning, and the planning process does involve, of course, finding other kinds of treatment facilities, whether they're maybe not a treatment facility now, but certainly locating places for people who are ill. But secondly, some of the funding does would be providing medical supplies that need to be stockpiled, masks, gloves, cots, blankets, sheets. I do have Dr. Harry Hall as well as Chris Erisman here who can give you more specifics about that, and I would like them to do so.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself. And
Chris Erisman, Minnesota Department of Health. Yes, the part of the planning that has been ongoing is surge capacity for hospitals, and so that's looking at off-site facilities, where people could be cared for. But as part of that process, obviously, as you've identified, we need to purchase cots. We need to purchase some of the supplies that would be utilized in those facilities because it won't be possible to do that at the time of a pandemic. And then as the Deputy Commissioner indicated, there is a line item for purchasing of supplies such as cots, masks, and potentially respirators, although I think that may not be our first choice just because it's a higher level healthcare response in a situation where we'll be very, very stretched. But I'll let Dr. Hall comment.
Dr. Hall, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and proceed.
I'm Dr. Harry Hall. I'm the state epidemiologist with the Minnesota Department of Health. I think that Ms. Erisman has pointed out a number of important factors that we will have to have off-site care facilities. We will have to provide the equipment as much as we can to care for people. And it's going to have to be a reduced standard of care. There won't be enough respirators. I mean, currently we have less than 1,000 respirators in the state. But you have to remember that every respirator requires at least one nurse full-time to care for them. So we already have a nursing shortage here in the state, and additional respirators have been touted as a potential solution, but they are not a solution. So we really have to look at how can we get the maximum number of people through this with the minimum number of deaths.
Dr. Hall, do you have the statutory authority and the civil protections to provide that reduced level of care?
Mr. Chairman, we have in previous legislative sessions worked on emergency preparedness issues, and we believe that many of them have been addressed, that we can provide liability protection for volunteers, liability protection for medical staff working at a level below the standard of care that they've been trained to provide. So we want to thank the legislature for their farsightedness in helping address those issues.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Hebler.
Just one for Dr. Hull. This is for $10 million or $10.5 or something. How much do you wish you could ask for if there was no limit? Is this 10% of what you need, really, or is it is this plenty? Or?
Representative Abler, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Dr. Hall.
I can't tell you how much money would be required. And part of the issue that we get into is even if we got money, for example, it would be wonderful if we could have supplies of Tamiflu, the antiviral drug, for every citizen in the state. But even if you appropriated the money to do that today, we wouldn't probably have that drug in stock for 5 or 6 years. The deputy commissioner said earlier that no matter how much planning we do, it's not enough. I would agree with that.
Ms. Arrowstrom, go ahead.
Chairman and members of the committee, one thing that we do know that we need that is not fully included in this budget would be purchasing masks that could be used by healthcare providers. And so those are about $1 a mask. And if you consider the number of healthcare providers and kind of the ability to maybe get a new mask every once in a while they'd be caring for patients, that would be definitely an increase in cost. So that would go well beyond the $10.5 million, just as a concrete example.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is a question that I've asked, and so I'd do it in front of the entire committee, and that is that you're certainly aware that there's also considerable federal resources that have been extended, and I'm wondering if we could get some sort of an accounting from the Department of Health so we coordinate our resources. I don't think the states aren't the only ones making investments in this area.
Introduce yourself and...
Mr. Chair, Margaret Kelly with the Department of Health. We do currently receive funding from the federal government for bioterrorism preparedness. And with all of our federal funding, the requirements of how those dollars are spent are very prescriptive, and we need to do the activities prescribed by the federal government. Bioterrorism preparedness has been focused on disaster-type single-event occurrences. If something were to happen with a building or within a city, an event that would last less than 30 days. And so we have been doing planning around those activities. Pandemic influenza would be a very different type of planning because it will be not just one building or not just one part of the state. It would be everywhere. It would not just last 10 days or 30 days. It would last months. And so it's a totally different type of preparing that we have not been given guidance from the federal government as to the money that we currently receive from them and the ability to shift gears and focus our planning from one type to another. And there is a small amount of federal dollars coming down, $1.7 million currently, to do specific pandemic influenza preparedness. And we are working with locals and with the federal government to identify how those dollars should be spent. This budget assumes that we will be using those dollars in addition to the $10.5 million request.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question on the antivirals. Those, what's the length of time is that? What's the expiration on those things?
Dr. Hall.
Or do they not?
Mr. Chairman, the expiration is 5 years.
Okay, thank you. And then it looks, Mr. Chair, one more quick.
Representative Thiessen.
It looks on the personal supplies that pushed out into 08 and 09. Is that going to be, it looks like you're kind of front loading the antivirals, I'm assuming because of the federal match or something, and then you're pushing out the purchase of the other supplies for the next biennium. Is that, I mean, is that going to be too late or in enough time, or did it just have an issue of priorities?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Thiessen, yes, currently there's a federal match, and so that if we were to purchase antivirals at this time, there'd be a 25% federal match, so there's an advantage to that, as well as the fact that we need to be able to put an order in, if you will, so that we get in line. So that's part of the emphasis. And I think in terms of, you know, is it ideal to get everything at once? Yes, but I think we recognize that it's possibly unlikely that we would be able to get all those things right this minute, so we would purchase antivirals first and then move on.
All right. Representative Pepin.
Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who this would be addressed to exactly, but I'm just looking at the line 7.15, and it says the $10.5 million is for preparation, planning, and response, and I'm particularly interested in response, and Representative Abler asked a bit of the question I'm interested in, but I'm concerned about if something were to happen, how much money would be needed at the time. I'm not specifically talking about preparedness. I'm talking about if it happened, you've done this preparation. What I'm getting at is there a need to have some type of a fund that's sitting there, not necessarily used, only there in case we have an outbreak, some type of a revolving fund or something that if it's not used, if we don't have an outbreak, it can be used for something else at a later date.
Mr. Chairman,
Dr. Hall.
Representative Pepin, that particular issue is not addressed in this funding, but I will say that in our prior emergency preparedness funding or legislation, there was a provision that when the governor declares an emergency, then the legislature would be called into session also. So I think that the legislature would be in a position to deal with those requests at that point in time.
Any further questions from the committee?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. You in particular better start hiding away masks because first responders are going to really, I think, bear the brunt of what happens. And you need to do whatever you can to protect yourself. And I will also say that the 1917 flu, we now know, was a bird flu that mutated and became able to be live in animals and be communicated from one to another. So we know the bird flu is out there again. It's already in some animals, but only animals that tend to eat birds. And so the virus is in animals, and it may mutate in those animals and spread to us. We need to be prepared as much as possible.
Hi. I believe we have Ms. Arrestrom wants to comment on that.
Well, actually, I was just, if you were closing out the discussion, I just wanted to make a comment on, I think that when you look at preparedness activities, sometimes it feels like you're investing in something that may or may not happen, and if it doesn't happen, then have you been a bad steward of your resources? And I think it's important to note that many of the activities that have been conducted by the department up until this point and will be conducted related to preparedness have benefited us in other ways. So the community is already benefiting, even though we haven't had a pandemic. And as an example of that, I'll just comment. I think many of you are aware of all the media attention this fall to some polio cases that were identified in the Amish community. And that was identified because of some of the laboratory systems that we have in place through our emergency preparedness so that our labs are reporting to us. So I think I just wanted to comment on that because I think sometimes you look at these dollar amounts and it's easy to think that you're investing in something that may or may not happen, so it feels a bit like Russian roulette. But I think if you keep in mind as well that there are definite ongoing benefits day to day for the work that we're doing in emergency preparedness, even if nothing happens.
I think that's well said. Representative Pepin had it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley and Dr. Hall and all of you, I'm just wondering, my concern too, I have an additional concern with the pandemic, and that would be, you know, Minnesota's got, I believe, I'm not an agriculture expert, but I believe it's one of the top, maybe first or second turkey producers in the country, and I'm concerned about, and I'm concerned about what would happen with turkey production. You're perhaps not the right group to ask, but I remember one of the other countries seeing that the turkey production, or the poultry consumption had gone down like 70% after this had broken out in the country, and I'm concerned from an economic point of view, what happens if this hits here and it hits our turkey supply, what that would do to our economy. And that's just, I guess it's not really a question, it's just a comment for the committee to think about, because this isn't just, this is about health, but it's also about our whole economy. Dr.
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Dr. Hall,
I could provide some comments. Please remember that I'm a physician and I'm not an agriculture expert, but it's my understanding that because there have been prior low pathogenicity avian flu outbreaks here in Minnesota in the poultry population in the past, that our poultry industry has taken a very proactive approach so that almost all the flocks are indoors. There's a high level of biosecurity here. So the potential for spread among our commercial flocks is substantially reduced in Minnesota compared to situations that you'd see in the Far East where the flocks are outside. So I think that we should complement our poultry industry in looking forward in terms of dealing with this. As far as consumption is concerned, I think that we might see an initial decline, but once people understood that it was safe, it wouldn't be so much of a problem. And I think that also this particular proposal includes funding for not just the Department of Health, but other sections of state government, and making sure that the Board of Animal Health, Department of Natural Resources, Department of Agriculture are prepared to deal with the animal aspects of this outbreak is terribly important.
All right. Representative Bradley, do you have any closing comments concerning the health department requests?
Well, we have additional sections to review.
I'd forgotten.
Mr. Chair, can I just have one
more? Representative, please, sorry.
On the grants to local government, it says that you listed there's going to be criteria. Is there going to be geographic? What's going to kind of be some of the criteria? I'm assuming that money is not going to cover all the requests. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen,
the
grants to locals will go out to local public health agencies, local emergency management directors. There will also be grants for tribal governments and for hospitals. And the grants we're still working out the fine details, but there'll be a base award to each entity and possibly a population-based component to the formula. Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I could walk through the details of the budget for this proposal, or we could move on.
Representative Bradley, what's your sense on that?
My suggestion, unless members want to do that, would be, I think members can look, you've got the budget page, and you've got that green sheet that gives you the breakdown.
That sounds reasonable.
I don't see the need to go walking through something that we have in front of us. I think you've got a really good handle on the general idea of what this is about, what the total amounts are.
Yeah, is there any other comments concerning this particular section of the budget request? Seeing none, we can move on then to the Minnesota eHealth Initiative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The proposal for the $12 million proposal is one-time funding for electronic health technology. This proposal will invest in the use of interoperable electronic health record systems, specifically in rural and underserved areas of the state. The importance of electronic health technology was underscored in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina.
The hurricane destroyed the paper records for nearly all those displaced by the disaster. They were left without medical or medication histories. In contrast, the medical records of those in VA hospitals, which are held electronically, were available within several days to veterans needing care. I have Scott Leitz here, who is our Director of the Office of Health Policy, Statistics, and Informatics, who is able to discuss or answer your questions in this proposal in greater detail.
Mr. Leitz, welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Scott Leitz with the Minnesota Department of Health. As Deputy Commissioner Boudreau indicated, this request is for $12 million to provide funding to healthcare providers in Minnesota to encourage the use of electronic health records and related health information technology. A recent survey by the American Hospital Association conducted in Minnesota indicated that 96% of the hospitals surveyed indicated that the cost of health information technology was a somewhat or significant factor in the adoption of electronic health records among hospitals in Minnesota, and only approximately 19% of hospitals in the state actually have fully functional electronic health records. Similarly, there's large disparities that exist in the use of electronic health records throughout the state. Among larger clinics, physician clinics in the state, they're about twice as likely to have electronic health records as smaller clinics are in Minnesota. This grant program focuses then on providing financial assistance to rural and underserved healthcare providers in Minnesota who have less financial wherewithal than larger providers do to purchase and put in place electronic health records and health information technology. The grant program would require the providers to be part of a community collaborative where at least three parts of the healthcare delivery system in a given community, that could be community clinics, could be small rural hospitals, nursing facilities in a given community, the local public health system, or other types of providers, would get together to purchase electronic health records. Grant funds would then be used for projects that allow for electronic interoperability of those programs. The grants would be available on a 3-to-1 match basis for three state dollars available for every $1 provided in cash or in kind by the providers, with maximum grants of $900,000 for each provider. In addition, the initiative calls for a $500,000 per year appropriation to the department to provide technical assistance, coordination, evaluation, and resources to those providers in the development of their electronic health record programs.
Thank you for testimony. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Leitz, the interoperability of these systems, is that just within a local community so that the clinic can talk to the hospital, or is that statewide? And I'll give you the example of my community where there one hospital just spent about $50 million on this, and the other one spent $25 million, and they don't talk to each other.
Mr. Chair, Representative Putley, the interoperability initially would be between the partners of the community collaborative. However, what we are asking for in the grant project is a plan for how they intend, as standards emerge for interoperability between systems that aren't currently talking to each other, a plan for how they intend to do that, because that is the goal, is that the systems, regardless of whether they were developed independently, that over time they will be able to talk to each other to provide that interoperability.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Chair. I have two questions. Just to kind of follow up on Representative Huntley's question, why is it, since we're now going to start spending some cash on this, we wouldn't suggest to these groups what system they might use, at least for all these new ones, will be the same? Have you thought about that?
Ms. Leitz.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, at this point, what's happening at the federal level is that the standards are emerging around how interchange will occur. And really what they're focusing on is developing ways for systems that are developed at an individual provider level, that they're, regardless of the system, that they're able to talk to each other. So at this point, what we're really focusing on is ensuring the partners can talk to each other, and that they have a plan in place to be able over time to talk to the other systems as federal standards are developed. At this point, we're not necessarily saying you should pick a given vendor, but rather to work with the emerging federal standards that will allow those different vendors to be able to talk to each other.
And Representative Abler.
You know, just based on health match, I'll tell you how quickly $10 million can go. wrong department, but I'm sure you've heard of it. Do you know how, have you decided how great the need is? If you could, how much could you spend on this for that, in determining what these needs for these, this subset of groups are? How many of these kind of sites are there so far, do you know?
Mr. Light.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, we're anticipating anywhere of up to 15 grants or so, depending on the size and scope of the proposals that come in.
Mr. Edgesmith, how much is then what's the unmet need that still remains? Do you have an idea? Is it like 10 times that much, or do you have any idea?
Mr. Light.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, at this point, we believe this is a good start in terms of providing funding available to those rural sites. I think as this program develops, we'll get a stronger sense of where the unmet need is. We believe that this grant program is really focused, though, on those providers who will likely have the highest unmet need.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Representative O'Tremba, Ms. Lights, apparently Representative O'Tremba has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also was going to ask about the rural pieces. We know that there are rural areas that literally have no technology to participate in this. And so are we making some sort of special effort to either upgrade what they have so that they can be, so they don't get out of the loop? I know that most of the larger systems have something up and ready, but there are numerous rural areas that even if they wanted to, couldn't. And so can you tell me how you're addressing that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Tremba, clearly the backbone or the high-speed information systems that need to be placed to deliver things need to be in place regardless. The grant pro and that's a separate track that's occurring for where information technology is getting out to rural areas of the state through not necessarily through this grant program. What this grant program would do would be to really target those small rural providers because they are the ones who are least likely to have this type of information technology available to them. And probably the least likely to have the financial wherewithal to be able to put in this type of technology. So this grant program is very much focused on those rural providers.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thank you, sir. Commissioner, immigrant health proposal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is the last of our three proposals. The final proposal is immigrant health, and this is a $500,000 initiative to improve outcomes for immigrants around perinatal hepatitis B and tuberculosis. Over the past few years, Minnesota has seen an increase in the number of women with the hepatitis B virus infection who are giving birth, and 99% of the births occur among non-white or Hispanic mothers, many of whom do not speak English. If not treated with vaccine immediately after birth, the child has a 90% chance of developing chronic hepatitis B. Treatment initiated within 12 hours after birth is up to 90% effective at preventing the infection. Similarly, the majority of TB cases in Minnesota, about 87%, occur among foreign-born persons, particularly new arrivals, refugees, and immigrants arriving to the United States. It's becoming more common for TB cases to be resistant to at least one of the common TB drugs, requiring more costly drugs for longer periods of time. A multi-drug resistant TB case can cost as much as $25,000, compared with $800 for a more typical case. This proposal would provide the needed consultation and reimbursement to local public health agencies to ensure better health care outcomes for immigrants and ensure the needed medications are available to treat those infected with TB. Chris Erisman is here again, and she's still here, our Director of Immunization, Tuberculosis, and International Health, as you've already met her, and she's here today if you have questions on this particular proposal.
Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, Representative Bradley, any ending comments on these proposals?
No, Mr. Chair, I certainly suggest that members take a look at the language. There is language in there about the e-health as far as the methodologies and priorities for distribution. I'll also suggest that you take a look at the budget pages, where the funds are coming from. Proposal, we haven't really discussed that very much. By and large, I think you're going to see Healthcare Access Fund as being a source for these, so be mindful of those things. We will be, the next step, I'm assuming that members had questions about language with bachelors today, so when we come back and ultimately review the Department of Human Services, we'll have been holding this, all this over for possible inclusion. But I hope that we've concluded and responded to members' questions about now the Veterans Organization and now the Health Department Organization, because now we'll be moving on to the Department of Human Services.
All right.
Thank you, Mr.
Deputy Commissioner, thank you
and
for your
committee members.
Testimony. As Commissioner Goodnow approaches the table, Representative Bradley, is it your wish to have the commissioner testify until noon, then we break and
yeah,
come back? Was it 7 p.m.?
Right. Mr. Chair, I think we ought to try to cover as much as we can. Again, you do have the budget pages. We probably will have some discussion, but the mental health bill, which is being carried separately by Representative Emmer, I believe we're scheduling that to be heard later in the week. Wednesday. Okay. So might you be mindful of that? We'll hear more of the details. We can at least see the numbers and the concept in the budget page, but we will be coming back to that because that's being carried in a separate bill. Otherwise, I believe pretty much all of the Department of Human Services areas are in here. And I will leave it to Commissioner Goodnow about how, but it might be good in the short term that we have to give sort of an overview and then to maybe go through so that people here have a picture of what are the various elements, and then I suspect when we come back tonight that we can then go through in more detail. I don't think we'll have enough time here to go through each of the items in detail, but I'm open to suggestions if the commissioner has another strategy. But I'll turn it over to the commissioner so we can begin the presentation of the Department of Human Services budget.
Thank you. Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kevin Goodnow, Commissioner of Human Services for the state of Minnesota. And I learned a long time ago that when Representative Bradley makes a suggestion, that it's a great idea. So I will give a brief overview.
Tell the rest of the world, Commissioner.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, when you're the chief author of our bill, you're always right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. I just want to give you a brief overview about the bill. Basically, the initiatives coming from the Department of Human Services fall into two categories. Those that we would consider emergencies and budget fixes, things that we need to have this session, and those that would be priority investments that the governor's put out in his budget proposal. Just to talk at a real high level, the general fund spending, or the spending over the next biennium, the 06-07 biennium, in the combination of all these areas, is about $79.3 million out of the general fund, $5 million out of the Healthcare Access Fund, and $10.1 million out of the TANF Fund. Those are net figures for 06-07. More specifically, when it comes to the emergencies and budget fixes area, basically our initiatives with regard to state-operated services would fall into that category. Those would include the appropriations we're requesting with regard to the growth or unexpected growth in commitments with regard to sex offenders and the mentally ill and dangerous. That total for those various initiatives is about $83.8 million in the general fund. That includes the Minnesota Security Hospital, which is for the mentally ill and dangerous individuals, for $31 million. Minnesota Sex Offender Program of $33.7 million. And then the Community Options for the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options Program of $2 million. Those are all related to increases in our civil commitments more than we expected. Now, the one key thing about all those programs is that these are folks that are civilly committed to us for care by the courts. So we don't have the option of saying no to them when they come. We are obligated under state statute to provide services to these individuals. In addition to that, the governor's proposal included a salary deficit or supplement of $17.1 million. The money, although separated out in the budget, they are interconnected. In other words, if you fund the growth and commitments but don't fund the salary supplement, then you're really not truly funding the growth and commitments as well, because it's all money that we use to fund salaries, fund services for the people that are being civilly committed to us, either as mentally ill and dangerous, as sex offenders, or as mentally ill, or the other categories that they fall into. Another item under the emergencies and budget fixes is the alternative care shortfall. That results in a $2.6 million of spending in the general fund for this biennium. The alternative care program is a program for seniors who are not eligible for the MA programs or MA elderly waiver program. The way we work with this program, it's not an entitlement program per se, so it's not forecasted. But we do forecast the expected enrollment, and since its inception, what we've done is come in every legislative session to either provide the savings to the legislature so they can take it if enrollments are below projections, or ask for the to fully fund that. So it's a way, rather than making it an entitlement program, it's a way to continue to provide services for the needed elderly. In addition to that, the health care federal compliance and eligibility fixes relative to the DEFRA bill that passed the federal government. We have some things that we're required to do under federal legislation. The proposals with regard to that are included in here as well. That has a net cost of, in this biennium, of $0.9 million and a health care access in the general fund and a health care access fund savings of $0.8 million. Now, with regard to priority investments, we have our mental health delivery system transformation, or mental health initiatives that Representative Bradley referenced, that Representative Emmer is carrying, that we will, I believe the hearing is on Wednesday. The net impact of the health care access fund is $3.4 million in this biennium. We have the prescription drug access program, which is two parts to that, one related to Medicare Part D and helping people make the proper choices and when they enroll. And one is a new program, the Minnesota Pharmacy Access Program, and the net cost of those programs is $2.2 million out of the Healthcare Access Fund. We also have an initiative related that was included in our sex offender initiative from the governor to study youth at risk of becoming sex offenders. That's $0.2 million out of the general fund. We have a pay-for-performance initiatives related to our health initiatives, which would provide pay-for-performance to people who are medical providers serving people with diabetes, and also pay-for-performance with regard to nursing facilities. So there's two components to that. Net impact of that is about $0.1 million, $100,000 in general fund, and $200,000 out of health care access fund. We have a couple of rate increases for the various nursing homes. I know you heard the bill earlier today on the St. Cloud area. We also have one with regard to Agua Ching, and I'm not certain if you've heard that one yet, but we can go into further detail on that. And finally, in our budget, and I'm not sure if that's carried in this budgetary, the TANF money, that's in the other committee, right? So I won't talk about that. Okay, very good. That's it for my overall presentation. At this point, I have with me today this CEO for our State Operated Services, Mike Tesner, and he can go into more detail about the State Operated Services budget initiatives.
Mr. Tesner, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to start with the Minnesota Security Hospital page. I believe it's page 11. The Minnesota Security Hospital serves individuals civilly committed to the commissioner as mentally ill and dangerous. This page represents a response to a dramatic increase in the utilization of that program. Up until about a year and a half ago, we experienced about 5 net patients growth per year, and at this point we're experiencing 25 net patient increase per year. 25 is essentially opening one unit per year. Additionally, we've had a slowdown in discharges out of the program. The discharge process for persons who are mentally ill and dangerous is a administrative process and legal process. What we've experienced in the last year and a half is essentially zero number of individuals being discharged under provisional discharge to the community, which has caused a substantial growth in the transition program on the campus. We also have had an increase in patients being committed to us in a treat to competency. These are individuals who have some type of involvement with the criminal court system and are found not competent to proceed to trial. Court orders them into our bed for treatment until they're competent, and while they're in our bed, of course, we're obligated to treat them and then report back to the court. And then lastly, there is a increase. We've had four juveniles committed to us as mentally ill and dangerous in the past year, which required us to open a juvenile unit to serve those individuals. Any questions on that page?
Any questions from the committee? Representative Brad.
Mr. Chair, just to point out to the committee, if you recall when we reviewed the bonding request, there are some interrelated items, particularly in Moose Lake. I think part of this is handled by agreements with the corrections area. So from a facilities point of view, this represents kind of a change in strategy. I believe prior years we were looking at St. Peter. The growth, the ability to plan interim has resulted in Moose Lake combinations with corrections and then ultimately expansion of the Moose Lake treatment facility as well. And we've already talked about that, but I just wanted to remind members that there is an interrelation here.
Thank you, Representative Bradley. Representative Abler.
Just a question about the CTR. Is this an appropriated account, not a forecasted one? Is that why we have an adjustment we have to approve?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's an appropriated program.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions on this?
Well, I think that one more thing with appropriations, Chair. If we don't give you the money, where are the people going to go? Are they going to visit your houses? Do you have the commissioner take them home for the weekend or something? Or what really happens if we don't give you the money?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have adopted the
Commissioner
program. But, Mr. Chair, basically, we would still be obligated to take them if they're still committed to us, so we'd be spending a deficit.
All right. Any further questions? Mr. Tesner?
Moving to... Mr. Chair, members of the committee, moving to the next page on the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. As Representative Bradley has pointed out, this year, based upon an acceleration in the growth that we were experiencing last year, this time last year we anticipated that the population would grow as many as 24 to 36 net patients a year. What we've actually experienced is we're growing at a rate of now 58 patients per year. What that essentially did was it caused us to fill up a building on the St. Peter campus that we anticipated lasting, giving us 3 years worth of growth in the span of 1 year. Back to Representative Bradley's comments about our partnership with the Minnesota Department of Corrections. We are, at this point in time, opening a 250-bed package of residential units on the Moose Lake Correctional Campus. It's segregated from the correctional facility so that we don't run into problems with mixing populations. It is going to give us a space for us to grow between now and the time that we construct the new case structure. The unprecedented growth in the sex offender program has caused us to do a number of different things. We've looked at the type and level of treatment that individuals are receiving to ensure that people who are refusing treatment, not cooperating with treatment, are separated from those individuals who are participating in treatment. That gives us a more efficient, effective treatment model for the folks that are participating in treatment. It also gives us the opportunity to keep closer track of the guys who are not participating. Many of them are engaged in behaviors that have been determined to be criminal or get them in trouble with Department of Corrections release violations. In the past year, 14 of those individuals have been returned to the Department of Corrections either because they were prosecuted for new crimes or they violated the conditions of their release. Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions on that.
Any questions on that particular section? Seeing none. You may proceed, Mr. Tesner.
The next page is dealing with the Minnesota Extended Treatment Options. This is a program that serves persons with mental retardation who are civilly committed to the commissioner for treatment. The primary characteristics is that they present a risk to public safety. Likewise, in the past year, actually dating back to last summer, we've seen an increase in the utilization of civil commitment with this population. Historically, that program has run about an average daily census of 30. Today, it's up to 44. Licensed capacity of the program is only 48, so we need to take some action in order to ensure that we don't the program doesn't fill up and we're not able to respond to court order treatment. What this proposal is doing is using a creative alternative strategy than adding beds, and that is to add a system of statewide crisis services that will be available to people at risk of the MEDO program. It will serve that person in their existing home or a crisis setting or a hospital, wherever the person is, stabilize them and help keep them safely and effectively in the community. In the event, of course, that they can't be served in the community, they would expedite the admission into the program. Likewise, that crisis service model will work at the back door of the program when people are stable and ready to go to help transition that person back to the community. It's our feeling that this model will help stabilize the population so we're operating within the existing residential program and not have to worry about expanding the number of beds of the program. We're anticipating collecting, I believe, about 60% of the cost of this service through primarily medical assistance.
Any questions from the committee concerning this section? I see none. Mr. Tesner, you may proceed.
The next page is the salary deficit. This is the cost of living increase for the appropriated part of state-operated services. This represents the increased cost from the negotiated agreements with the bargaining units. It covers the adult mental health side and the existing forensic services. I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Any questions there, committee? Seeing none, proceed.
And then the last page is, Commissioner Goodnow referred to this earlier, 60% of the men civilly committed as sex offenders, 60% have predatory sexual behavior that began either as a child or as an adolescent. The number of admissions into the program between the ages of 18 and 24 accounts for about 20% of the admissions. These are people who have multiple offenses in their as a child or adolescent. They have typically have one offense as an adult, and then civil commitment occurs after their criminal sentence is run. What this proposal is doing is looking at a two-pronged approach to try to better understand what's happening with kids and adolescents. It's looking at the existing adult population who offended as a child, adolescent, and what are the dynamic risk factors that seem to be present with that population. That's one prong of it. The other prong is looking at existing children and adolescents who are exhibiting predatory behavior, and essentially using that same dynamic set of risk factors to determine, how can we best identify kids that are going to turn up in the adult system and subject to civil commitment in the future, and hopefully identify what better treatment and supervision practices can be applied to that population.
I got any questions concerning that? Representative Bradley, it looks like this may be a good time to break, given the...
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. We think we might be able to avoid another group of people and skip to continuing care, and that would only take about 5 minutes or so.
And that's about what we've got. Yes, if we can bring them down, that would work.
Mr. Chairman, Assistant Commissioner Lauren Coleman is here to talk about this. And I believe we can expedite that because a couple of the individual bills have already been heard in that area as well. So.
All right, Mr. Coleman.
Good morning. Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner for Continuing Care at the Department of Human Services. For reference, I'm on page 44, beginning with the performance incentives payments for nursing facilities. As everyone is aware, for several years we've been working on a new payment reimbursement system for nursing facilities. It seems like a very long time, but it's been about 5 years. And we have had a number of significant achievements during that time that has helped move along reform to the payment system. Some of those would include reforming the case mix system to a single case mix system, agreeing on quality measures and displaying those in a report card, implementation of a consumer satisfaction survey where the actual residents are expressing their feedback on experiences, and several others. Although we would like to be able to announce that we have an agreement on a new payment system, that achievement is yet to be successful, but we do have an interest in moving along the continued improvement in quality in nursing facilities, and so we are proposing taking funding that has been earmarked for hold harmless in a new payment system in the future, and using that money to amend current alternative payment system contracts on a competitive basis to improve the services for people living in nursing facilities. There would be the next incremental step. It would not mean that it is a new system, but it is trying to continue the improvement of services to people in nursing facilities.
Any questions for the committee concerning this proposal? Seeing none, the alternative care program funding shortfall, is that your next item?
Next in the packet is the rate increase for vet and turbine insurance, and I know you've already heard that this morning, so we'll skip through that. We do have on page 47 the AGWA chain.
Mr. Coleman, we've done AGWA chain as
well. I'm sorry. Okay, the alternative care program funding shortfall has been referenced by Commissioner Goodnow. It is to adjust the funding to allow those who need this support to remain in their homes to do so.
Okay. Any questions on any of that, members? I believe we're going to recess. We'll be back here at...
I have a question.
Mr. Abler?
For the commissioner, when they come back, not about this, but just about it. Mr. Goodnow, do you think when you come back as part of your evening's presentation, you could touch on this $93 million, $87 million, whatever this perfect case of management. Who can you mention that when you come back?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Well, the federal talked in that.
Mr. Chair,
is that part of the tonight's talk anyway?
Commissioner Goodnow.
We will have a discussion with regard to the mandatory requirements that we have in this initiative. But the issue with regard to the other potential cuts, the impacts on counties.
Just an update would be nice, is all I'm suggesting.
Well, the update right now is that the feds have not issued the regulation, so we don't know for certain what the actual impacts will be.
Oh. As simple as that. Okay. Thank you.
All right. We will be back here at 7 p.m. in this room. If you would just put your materials back into your packets, we'll save them for you. We are in recess.
We'll call the Health Policy and Finance Committee back to order from our recess. I think since we have Representative Coles here, why don't we do a House File 3552. I'll move House File 3552 for possible inclusion, and I will acknowledge, because I believe there's a part of the Governor's Bill that's in the Jobs Committee, and then we have this one here. One of them has money coming from the Healthcare Access Fund. I believe this one comes from a different source. We'll figure that out, but for tonight, we'll be holding this over for possible inclusion. I have to tell members that I've had a lot of time and chance to get to know this, and a lot of you who've been involved in the prior efforts on biosciences and genomics know a lot about it, too. We don't have some of the people who've worked on, but I think we've got excellent testifiers here. We don't need to spend a lot of time tonight, but I do think, though, that we should give the opportunity. So with the motion having been made, Representative Coles, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I just want to make sure that I'm understanding procedurally where we're at, because it's my understanding that House File 3552 is actually currently in the possession of the Jobs Committee. So I'm just concerned about...
Is it? Well, then I can't make my motion. We'll just hear it tonight.
Okay,
we'll straighten out that
Mr.
later.
Mr. Chairman, if you want to throw this in your bill at the end of the day, because that's where the money ought to come, you know,
well,
let's deal with that when we get there. But I appreciate the opportunity
absolutely.
To be here.
Let's go through it.
And I appreciate your support of the biosciences and the bipartisan support that we've seen for the university and Mayo Genomics Partnership. Mr. Chair and members, last year we appropriated money for the first time we appropriated money again to the Genomics Partnership to fund research. I have with me individuals from both the university and Mayo who could talk a little bit about some of the research that was funded with last year's appropriation, and then we can chat a little bit about the bill, but the bill is fairly simple and straightforward, Mr. Chairman and members. It calls for $18 million to be appropriated to the University of Minnesota and Mayo Foundation's genomics partnership to fund the ongoing research. It also includes a reporting requirement so that the legislature is kept apprised as to the research that is being funded. With that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to our friends from Frank's going to go first, I guess. So our friend from Mayo Clinic.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Frank Yossi. I'm here representing Mayo. And with me tonight is Marty McDonough, who represents University of Minnesota Academic Health Center. This request is the second year of a five-year plan in the governor's proposal for five years, $70 million to fund genomics research. It's actually for the official title of the organization, the Minnesota Partnership for Biotechnology and Medical Genomics. Last year, you funded $15 million in support. That was the first year's allocation, and it's now been allocated through a competitive grant mechanism. I should tell you that each of these proposals has to have a principal investigator from the University of Minnesota and one from Mayo Clinic. It has to be funding a research that neither institution can do on its own, and of course it has to have some element of genomics research. We received 50 proposals in total, totaling about $70 million, and therefore we ended up funding about one out of $4 or $5. So there's plenty of really, really good research that's waiting in the wings. I should tell you that the project proposals were reviewed by a distinguished panel of experts from across the country, and they were impressed both by the science and the degree of productive collaboration that's going on here. Highlights of the new projects that are just beginning are strategies to improve kidney transplantation outcomes, developing better predictors of cardiovascular disease, understanding genetic abnormalities in brain cancer, cancer drug development, and improved treatment for cocaine addiction. I also want to talk a little bit about an initiative that the partnership is doing statewide, and that's to, in collaboration with the BioBiz Alliance, which is the, result of the transition of the Governor's Biosciences Council to the private sector. We have begun to implement a statewide communication strategy to equip and train and provide guidance to localities around the state for the possibility of commercializing biotechnology and making it an economic development function across Minnesota. We've had workshops in St. Cloud and Worthington. We're going to have them in Mankato, Bemidji, yet this spring, and probably in Moorhead and a couple of other places next fall. And it's just been amazing the number of people who come to those things from all segments of the community, both in St. Cloud and in Worthington. So, Mr. Chair, this request is for $18 million for the second year of the five-year plan.
Thank you. Any additional testifier?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Marty McDonough, representing the University of Minnesota. Frank pretty much explained the need for these funds. I would just say that from the university perspective, the university and the Mayo Clinic have been seen as rivals for a long time, and we've seen some genuine leadership from our Academic Health Center Vice President Frank Serra with former Mayo Board of Governors Chair Hugh Smith, and it's passed on now to their new Board of Governors Chair, and the seriousness with which our scientists are collaborating, it's very exciting, both with the building project in Rochester as well as the research, and we'd ask you for continued support. Thank you.
Mr. McDonough, I thought that you'd probably take us through the past project that had been done, explain those in detail, and then take us through the additional projects that may be on the board and explain those in detail to the committee as well. Not tonight?
Maybe at a later date, Mr. Chairman.
But thanks for the opportunity.
Listen, of course.
It's really cool stuff.
Oh, yeah, that's the way those docs talk about it. I would say, though, members, in all seriousness, Mr. McGunn is absolutely right. The partnership, I think, has yielded beyond any expectations. A really terrific working relationship between two world-class organizations. And the strength of that puts us and keeps us in the running on what really is a race. It's a race not only in terms of the healthcare, but also, I think, in terms of economic benefits. And this is a pretty modest investment, wherever it might come from, in comparison to the oftentimes hundreds of millions of dollars
that are in Arizona, California, and some of the other states. So we are really fortunate in Minnesota to have a strong base to work from. Thank you. Any question, members? Representative Putney?
Could I ask Mr. Chair Marty McDonough about the double regression analysis?
Why don't you put your microphone down, because he'll need to hear this.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to ask Marty about some of the double regression analysis and how many standard deviations from the mean in these studies.
President Huntley, I think that the chair will allow for the two of you to gather later tonight, and you can spend all the time you want on that. There, are you off the hook, Mr.
Chair? Representative Huntley, I think his specialty is in the West Coast offense.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else here in the audience that wishes to testify regarding this bill? Well, we don't have a bill before, so we won't make any formal motions, but I do appreciate the opportunity for the committee to hear this tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
I believe we have an opportunity to wrap up business on two bills that we had before us this morning. First of all, there's the Severson. Representative Pepin's first. Representative Pepin, would you like to move your bill now, and then we can do the amendment and conclude that one? Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have, now that we have the bill in our possession, I just have a couple of amendments. One is the A1 amendment, and one is a quick oral amendment to get it in its proper shape.
I think, first of all, Representative Pepin would move House File 3625 for possible inclusion. Representative Pepin, do your amendments.
Let's do the oral one first on line 2.26 in subdivision 3. I wanted to change the word shall to may per our earlier discussions.
Representative Pepin moves to amend House File 3625 on line 2.26 to change the word shall to may. In discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. That amendment is adopted. Representative Pepin.
To the A1 amendment.
Representative Pepin moves the A1 amendment.
The amendment simply puts the appropriation back, and it's from the Health Care Access Fund, which was in the original form of the bill.
Members understand the A1 amendment? All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
No.
I think we now have the bill. Representative Pepin renews your motion that House File 3625 be considered for, as amended, be considered for possible inclusion in the bill. Chair will make that ruling.
Mr. Chair, members?
And now we have Representative Severson's bill before us. I move House File 3989 for possible inclusion. And members, this is the bill that gave the rate increase for Stearns, Sherburne, and Benton counties. We had the presentation before. Any questions? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Actually, I didn't have to vote. I don't know why I did that. But anyway, you've even had an official vote.
Well, that's awesome.
For possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for your
Thank
time.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Severson. Okay, I think that catches us up. And so, I will move, and Representative Finstead, you want to take over?
Representative Bradley, do we have this bill? Has there been a motion on this bill?
Yes, there was. You know, we probably a little bit didn't quite do the tabling that we should have done, but consider this bill now that we'll bring it off the table in a sense, and I'll just renew my motion that House File 3679, as amended, be held over for possible inclusion. And we'll have to catch up. As members recall, this is the governor's budget bill. We had, I think, gone through many of the sections. Perhaps Mr. Odberg would remember Which section now that we're ready to proceed to? Are you giving a handoff?
And Mr. Chairman, yes, members of the committee, page 24 of your budget packet, which is the Deficit Reduction Act 2005, state reaction to that.
Can you just reintroduce yourself for the tape and go ahead?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Brian Osberg. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Healthcare for the Department of Human Services. And I'd like to take you through the healthcare pages, beginning on page 24. This relates to the state compliance to the new federal Medicaid legislation. It's called the Deficit Reduction Act of 2005. It was just enacted last month. This contains a number of state mandates, which I'll go through, but also some state options affecting our medical assistance program. Now, most of these options and mandates relate to eligibility of our programs, especially for long-term care services. And this specifically provides for a state to come into compliance with DEFRA and adopts several state options and also adopts the MA system documentation requirements for our Minnesota Care and GAMC programs. Let me quickly go through those provisions. But first, we're still trying to seek clarification from CMS as to the impact of some of this legislation. Again, it just was enacted last month. Regulations are still forthcoming, and clarity from CMS is being sought by not only by us, but other states as well. And we're not sure to what extent our government is going to make further changes to the Medicaid program. There's talk about doing that again next year. Now, as you see in the budget page, there's a slight savings in 07, but more significant savings in 08 and 09 from this legislation. Now, the counties, however, get impacted much more financially because of this legislation. I think you've heard about that. However, again, the state, there's a slight savings because of this legislation. Now, it's also going to require a great deal of administrative and system changes. We're asking for staff positions to administer those changes and also trying to minimize certainly the impact this has on our Health Match program. Now, I could quickly go through these mandates and give you an understanding as to what they are, and then certainly take questions. The first one is the look-back period for asset transfers. Current state law requires a review of an MA applicant's uncompensated asset transfer for a 36-month period prior to an application for MA payment of long-term care services, and for 60 months for transfers involving certain trusts. This is known as the look-back period. DEFRA lengthens the look-back period for all compensated transfers made on or after February 8, 2006, from 36 months to 60 months, which will be phased in over time. Now, this was part of legislation that was enacted a few years ago by the state legislature. We were instructed at that point to seek a waiver from the federal government to extend the look-back period to 72 months. We're suggesting at this point that we will not any longer seek the 72-month look-back period, but we will certainly abide by the 60-month look-back period as provided by federal law. The second key provision relates to the penalty period. Currently, the penalty period for an uncompensated transfer begins on the first day of the month following the month in which the transfer occurred. Individuals ineligible for MA payment of long-term care services during the penalty period. DEFRA, the new federal legislation, requires that for applicants, the penalty period for uncompensated transfers made on or after February 8, 2006, begin in the first month in which the applicant would otherwise be eligible for MA payment of long-term care services, but for the penalty period. Again, the legislation that was enacted by the state a few years ago provided for this provision, whereby we would have a different penalty period than we've had in the past. So there are other provisions that we sought in that waiver that we're going to continue to seek, and we'll keep the waiver in front of the CMS. However, these first two provisions here were 60% of the savings from the legislation that was enacted a few years ago. The third key mandate is the undue hardship waiver. The federal government realizes that in some cases, certainly, applicants and recipients would have a hardship because of this provision. Federal law protects MA applicants and recipients from asset transfer penalties. When they can establish that a penalty would impose an undue hardship that would endanger the person's health or life. Again, effective for transfers made on or after February 8th, DEFRA requires states to permit nursing facilities to request a hardship waiver on behalf of a resident of the facility when payment of long-term care services is denied due to a penalty period, if the nursing facility obtains the consent of a resident or the resident's authorized representative. The next provision, again, mandated provision, is the treatment of annuities. Current law, current state law, treats certain annuities held by medical assistance applicants and recipients as countable assets or income, or in some cases as transfers of assets for less than fair market value. Again, effective for transactions taking place after February 8, 2006, involving annuities, DEFRA requires that one individual seeking MA payment for long-term care to disclose a description of any interest that the individual or community spouse has an annuity as a condition of eligibility for MA. Number two, that the state becomes a preferred remainder beneficiary of certain annuities in which an individual or community spouse has an interest by virtue of the receipt of MA. And number three, that the purchase of an annuity be treated as an uncompensated transfer of assets unless it meets certain criteria. The next mandated provision relates to the home equity limit. You may have read about this recently. DEFRA establishes the home equity limit of $500,000 for eligibility for MA payment of long-term care services. Up to this point, there has been no limit. Again, this is for applications made on or after January 1st, 2006. So it's retroactive in terms of the application. The acceptance, if a spouse, children under 21, or disabled children reside in the home. However, it permits individuals to use a reverse mortgage or home equity loan to reduce total home equity and requires CMS to establish a process to waive this provision in the case of a demonstrated hardship. Now, federal law does permit a state option to have that limit at $750,000. At this point, we're not proposing exercising of that option. I just want to let you know that DEFRA does provide for that. We believe that given what I just indicated about the ability to do reverse mortgages and home equity loans and the ability to have a potential waiver of this provision due to a hardship, we feel at this point that $500,000 is the appropriate limit. Now, the $500,000 also includes, in that definition, continuous land, includes farmland. I want to make sure you understand that. Treatment of financial interest. Current law, state law, is silent on MA treatment of financial interest in continuing care, retirement, and life care communities, and the ability of facilities to require spending of those interests as a condition of admission. DEFRA defines an entrance fee for continuing care, retirement, and life care communities as a countable asset for purposes of MA eligibility under certain circumstances, and we can go through that if you wish. The next point is treatment of certain loans. Effective for any transfer after February 8th, DEFRA defines the purchase of certain promissory notes, loans, or mortgages as an uncompensated transfer of assets. Again, a mandated provision. The next is life estates. Effective for transfers, again, after February 8th, DEFRA defines the purchase of a life estate interest in another individual's home as an uncompensated transfer of assets unless the purchaser resides in the home for a period at least 1 year following the purchase.
Excuse me. Sam Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to interrupt, and I apologize for that, but I wanted to explain something. We're now on page 28 of the budget book, but you just handed out to you a landscape chart that's kind of laid out. If you, I believe right now we're on about page 5 about of that. You'll find that you can track this. This is a good reference, I think, as you're trying to study this. This is fairly complicated areas, and I believe that most of the information is also in the budget pages, but sometimes this chart's a little easier. So this one's for your reference.
Thank you. Mr. Osberg.
Mr. Chairman, the other provision, mandated provision, relates to third-party liability. It allows the states to recover from other third-party payers, like pharmacy benefit managers and other insurance companies. Because of the vagueness of this language, we're not sure to what extent there is a cost savings. I'm hoping that there is, and perhaps by next session we can determine exactly what that may be. Because we're intending to seek and strengthen our ability to have health insurance made available to our clients. And we're working with the Child Support Division, in fact, on that possibility. Now, that, again, all those provisions are mandated. The next mandated provision relates to citizenship requirement. DECA requires that effective July 1st of this year, DHS must obtain acceptable documentation that applicants and enrollees are U.S. citizens or nationals. Current state law requires the self-declaration of U.S. citizenship under a penalty of perjury for purposes of MA eligibility. Applicants verify citizenship by their signature on the healthcare application. We recognize that there may be some logistical issues surrounding this. However, we are still trying to get clarity from CMS as to exactly what we can do about that. Because the provision, in essence, is not a condition for eligibility for people. It's a condition for us getting federal participation. And I'll describe in a second what we need to do to implement this. But notwithstanding these challenges, the logistical challenges, we are proposing to ensure uniformity in our programs that this provision applies to all of our programs, not just medical assistance. So we're suggesting that this apply to general assistance medical care and to Minnesota care where there's not federal financial participation. We believe, for various reasons, that is good policy. In part, this is important to allow a smooth transition between state and federal programs. For example, a GAMC enrollee who is determined disabled and eligible for MA, or a state-funded Minnesota care enrollee who becomes pregnant and eligible for federally funded Minnesota care. That way, it's easier to transition to the program that they're entitled to. It also assists enrollees in making sure that they're in the program that they're entitled to. Now, in terms of implementation, CMS has told states that applicants and enrollees must be given a reasonable opportunity to obtain acceptable documentation of their citizenship. Applicants and enrollees at renewal will be determined eligible based on a declaration of citizenship. So their eligibility will not be delayed necessarily, and it's incumbent upon us to help them determine that and secure those documents to declare citizenship. State or county agencies will be required to assist applicants and enrollees with obtaining the documentation. This assistance may include paying the cost of obtaining copies of a birth certificate or other documents. The state is eligible for federal matching funds for this assistance. Again, this is a provision as dictated by the federal law. Now, let me describe some of the optional provisions that we are suggesting that we exercise. DEFRA does allow states to exercise certain options. In fact, since the law just was enacted last month, we've not had a chance to assess all of those options. Some of those options include some flexibility around benefit sets and some cost-sharing flexibility as to how we can structure our programs. We intend to assess those options during the course of the next few months and come back to the legislature next year in terms of our recommendations and analysis. We have, though, exercised two options that are in your budget page here. One is for calculating what we call fractional assets, effective, again, for transfers after February 8th. We can add together all fractional asset transfers, meaning multiple transfers, for less than market value made during the look-back period for the purpose of calculating one penalty period. Second is that we're exercising the long-term care partnership provision. As you know, the legislature instructed Department of Human Services in prior sessions for us to participate in the long-term care partnership program. What this does, this program exempts assets from estate recovery equivalent to the amount of assets that have been utilized through a privately purchased long-term care insurance policy that conforms to specific requirements. And so we want to exercise that option. Before I go on to the next area of healthcare budget proposal, I'll stop there and see if there's any questions or clarification necessary around our compliance to the federal Medicaid legislation.
Representative Samuelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Osmond, the only question I really have is the date of 2-8, that's in retrospect again. And is that, why was 2-8 chosen, and is that going to be a problem as we move into the future?
Mr. Osmond. Chairman, Representative Samuelson, February 8th was the date in which the legislation was enacted. And so the provisions in DEFRA have, just like legislation that's enacted through the state legislature, sometimes the provisions are retroactive, sometimes they are effective the date of enactment, and sometimes they're effective later on. Most of these, what this provision says is that any transfer that takes place after February 8, 2006, then these provisions apply. And that was the decision by Congress.
Representative Jamison?
I guess we don't argue with Congress.
I'd beg to differ. Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the verification of citizenship piece, and as I understand it, Minnesota, we're not required to do that for Minnesota Care, but you think there's some administrative synergies if we do it that way?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, we're not required to do it where we have no federal financial participation. Right. General Assistance Medical Care, we do not have financial participation from the feds, but Minnesota Care, we do, except for the adults without children segment of Minnesota Care. So it's a minority of the people in Minnesota Care that would not be subject to that. So we're recommending not just for administrative ease, but we think it's appropriate policy if indeed the feds feel in their wisdom that this is appropriate policy. We believe then it perhaps would be necessary and appropriate to apply it to all of our programs.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. And, you know, and that's fine. We, you know, we can debate that policy. The question I had, though, is that we're allocating 3 FTEs from the general fund to administer this program for MA and presumably for DAMC, and we're allocating 20 FTEs from the Healthcare Access Fund to do the Minnesota Care. Strikes me that I can't imagine that there's 6.5 plus times applications to deal with the Minnesota Care side of it than the medical assistance side. And are these employees going to be dealing with all of them? And basically, are we taking Minnesota Care dollars to pay for medical assistance work, I guess is my ultimate question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, again, the Minnesota Care includes medical assistance dollars. Most of the federal dollars we have in Minnesota Care are medical assistance dollars, and some of them are the Children's Health Insurance Program. But I think the majority, about 11 positions are going to be related to federally funded programs, and about 8 positions relate to, no, 12, I guess, on federally funded programs and 8 on non-federally funded programs in terms of FTEs. That's the breakdown. So that's what we currently project. And we expect that this requires additional 10 minutes in terms of the application process. It has to be for everyone currently enrolled, not just new applicants. So everyone currently enrolled at the point at the renewal, that citizenship has to be documented.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I think you answered my question, though, that the division between the General Fund and Healthcare Access Fund does not reflect what's actually the processing of it, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Bradley.
Sure, Representative Thiessen. I'm not sure that I thought you were on an interesting point, because it is a relatively small add to the general fund for MA groups where there are significantly greater number of people who are on just MA. The fact that the Minnesota Care has some of the people, or most of the people, are on MA as well, doesn't explain the fact of 400,000 people versus 160,000. And why is it that, and Mr. Osberg, I think that's the question is, why is it that there's so much more effort apparently for Minnesota Care? And, you know, take the combination of MA and state-funded only, but why is it proportionally so much more effort as compared to the effort for 400,000 people in MA?
Mr. Osberg.
Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Karen Gibson, Department of Human Services. The 20 FTEs are actually needed in our Minnesota Care Operations area. This would be the state group that processes Minnesota Care apps. The 3 FTEs are needed for the family planning program, which we are hoping to implement July 1st. Counties will be responsible to document citizenship under GAMC and for medical assistance. So that's what the 3 FTEs are relating to.
Thank you.
So the point is going to be...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bradley, you're right. The counties, the impact on the counties is not calculated here.
And Mr. Representative, can we talk a little bit more about that piece of it right now?
Mr. Chairman, Scott,
the county, what you're anticipating on the county side.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, if the counties administer eligibility for general assistance, medical care, and medical assistance, and in some counties administer eligibility for Minnesota care, it's an option to the counties. Otherwise, the state administers eligibility for Minnesota care. And so we expect that the same impact is going to take effect for counties as well. Another additional 10 minutes is our estimate in terms of the impact on counties for medical assistance and GAMC.
Representative Thiessen.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess not just related to the citizenship piece, but more generally speaking, what the impact on counties of all these compliance with DEFRA. Do we have any sense of the financial impact of that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen. Yes, we do. We have a sense of, at this point, our best estimate is that the impact on counties on an annual basis would be for child support, child welfare, and TANF, those three areas, a total of $74 million a year. Now, that does not include the impact, potential impact that on counties regarding targeted case management. That potentially could even be greater than the total of $74 million. So we are trying to get clarification from CMS and as out of the counties as to exactly what's going to happen with targeted case management. But that could be as high as $80-some million on top of the $74 million. That could be as high as $80-some million if indeed, again, it all depends on how CMS interprets this. And we keep hearing different things regarding that.
Thank you.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just need quick clarification. The cuts that are coming are separate than the expected cost for the change in operating and in compliance with TEFRA. Right.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, the cuts that I was just describing are outside of this budget page. They're the cuts to the counties, at least the money that flows to the counties,
right,
to recipients. What I'm addressing here is the impact on the state only.
Okay.
And what we have to do to administer that impact.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we have the expected $80 to $120 million that is going to be decided later this year for case management solely. And then in addition to this, separate from the type of money that we're talking about in compliance for the state, you're talking about a minimum of $74 million for compliance operation for the counties, or is that a separate number? I want to make sure that I'm looking, because I think Representative Thiessen was initially asking not for the cuts, just for the compliance on what's the guesstimate that the county initially asking not for the cuts, just for the compliance on what's the guesstimate that the counties are going to have to be spending on just the compliance for TEFRA.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Osborne,
and Representative Walker, I apologize. We do not have a calculation of that at this point.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Osberger, are we ever going to get in print a sheet that that tells us what the cost is to the counties? And let me preface that. Is the county's answer to the state. They're our creation. Everything they do, we are responsible for. And so if we're going to have a budget passed that hits the county, looks like $74 million, on this, from the feds, and if there's another 80, 90 million on targeted case management, we're responsible as a state to deal with that. And at the very least, we ought to get something in print and have some testimony from counties as to what the impact of these cuts are, so that when we have to vote on the budget, we know what the budget is for the entire state, not just the state general fund or the state health care access fund, but also whether or not these costs are simply going to be transferred to the counties and ultimately to property tax increases.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me separate these two. The targeted case management is different than most of the things where it is a combination of state-federal funding, depending upon if we get federal participation, and it's a pass-through to the county, kind of state-funded, state-federal-funded and county-administered. In the case of targeted case management, the match that would normally be state actually is currently county money. And that goes back historically, apparently, to a time where the counties sort of made a deal because they believed that this was something that they wanted to get into. Now, you can still ask the question if the federal component, which we don't know yet because there is a case that is trying to be appealed with the congressional delegation to CMS to indicate that targeted case management as it's implemented in Minnesota is different than kind of the standard case management because it's so tightly integrated to the actual services. So what we're trying to do there is to appeal to say, as you're cutting back some of the case management where it's seemed to be maybe kind of another layer, that it's different in Minnesota. So that is a side, and the match there is not state dollars. The match is county money today, and that half of it. The other half of it is federal. On the $74 million, I'm intrigued myself, Mr. Osberg. I would have thought usually that we fund the administration and we get federal match on like the MA administration, that kind of thing. Am I missing something there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bradley, that $74 million does not relate to administrative dollars per se. So it relates to, again, funding that goes to the counties under the current TANF program and child support and child welfare. It's not related, because there is a federal match, you're right, on administrative services, both at the state level and the county level, and it's 50% federal match. So that's the best estimate that we have at this point in terms of impact on counties, and that analysis and a summary is certainly available, but it does not relate to the administrative services.
No. Mr. I may need to follow up. I don't want to hold it up entirely because I was confused. I thought I had just gotten done figuring out why it was 3 versus 20, and now I'm hearing that that's not what the 74 is for, that's something different. So I maybe it's the at night and my mind is not working real good, but are we in the same problem? You may have the same problem I do then.
Again,
we'll follow up.
Chairman, we do not include in this budget page any impact on the counties. That is not it's not jurisdiction.
All right, members, any further questions? Not Mr. Osberg?
On page 31 in the budget document is the issue relating to mandatory asset verification for JMC and Minnesota Care. This initiative would align the asset verification in those programs that we currently have for medical assistance. Last year, the legislature adopted a provision that provided for the requirement of verifying comparable assets for MA applicants. Although JMC and Minnesota Care applicants and enrollees must have assets no greater than the established limits, which are different than MA, verification of those comparable assets is not currently required in either program. And in Minnesota Care, we just added a couple of years ago a asset limit. Upon the implementation of HealthMatch, all applications for publicly funded healthcare will be treated as an application for the most advantageous program in terms of coverage and cost to the applicant, with MA at the top of the hierarchy. All applicants will want to submit verification of assets at that point in order for them to then be positioned to be eligible for medical assistance. Furthermore, without expressly mandating asset verification in JMC Minnesota Care law, some applicants will choose not to submit verification. So we believe that whether or not that was the intent of legislation last year, we believe that it's appropriate policy to apply to all of our programs. If we're going to verify assets for medical assistance, then we should be doing it for GMC and Minnesota Care as well.
That's an enabler.
Does that include verification by telephone, Mr. Osberg?
Mr. Chairman, it was an enabler. We will get to that in another bill. Yes. We're addressing that in our health care policy bill, Mr. Chairman. The next item is on page 33, which exempts certain GAMC groups from the shift to Minnesota Care. Based on legislation that was enacted last year, certain adults without children in general assistance medical care will be shifted to Minnesota Care after a temporary period of GAMC eligibility. In fact, that provision goes into effect September 1st of this year. After the initial six-month eligibility period, they will have to meet Minnesota Care eligibility requirements and pay a premium to continue coverage. In fact, during that first 6 months, the counties actually contribute to the premium. Current law exempts people who receive general assistance and group residential housing, or people who have a disability determination pending from that shift. We've identified other additional groups who should also be exempt from that transition. Primarily, they are people who cannot attain Minnesota Care eligibility at the end of the eligibility period. They would be required to reapply for the benefits through DAMC that they were just terminated from. This disrupts care as well as causes an unnecessary administrative burden for county agencies. These people, more specifically, are people with end-stage renal disease with Medicare benefits. You see the Medicare as a barrier to Minnesota Care eligibility, so they would not be eligible after the 6 months. People with private health insurance benefits, which we buy into, it's called cost-effective insurance. Access to private health insurance is a barrier to Minnesota Care eligibility once again. And people who retain GAMC eligibility when they are incarcerated and remain incarcerated at the end of the six-month GAMC eligibility period. In addition, people receiving services under the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund will have to move to Minnesota Care at the end of the first six-month eligibility period. We think that is not appropriate because we think that will compromise the health care, the continuity of the health care. The primary risk for this group is that in Minnesota Care, the $10,000 inpatient hospital cap applies, and there's multiple admissions for people who are receiving services under the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund. At least oftentimes there are multiple hospital stays. And enrollees also suffer other health problems that indeed we think would be more appropriately served under general assistance medical care. So we're suggesting that we add to the list of people who are not going to be subject to that shift. Any questions? Mr. Chairman, page 35 is the pay for performance provision for health care providers. This proposal provides for a payment for performance system for our publicly funded health care programs. The legislature was a catalyst in this last year when it directed Department of Human Services to begin working with the Minnesota Community Measurement Project and with the Hospital Association to begin tracking performance information. And what we want to do here is apply a payment for performance incentive to medical groups that demonstrate and provide optimal care to our enrollees with diabetes. We're following the Bridges to Excellence program, which is a private employer initiative, not only in this state, but throughout the country. So we're working with the Business Healthcare Action Group in developing this model. Again, this model is what it does is recognize good outcomes, and not just good process or good intent, but actually good outcomes. We'll actually give an incentive payment to those medical groups that exceed what's called the optimal standard as measured by the Minnesota Community Measurement Project. We want to add to this over time, but we think this is a good start. In fact, we want to do is have payment for performance for hospitals eventually, as well as for other conditions. We are in the process of working with other states and other business coalitions on developing these kind of proposals, and we encourage the legislature to adopt this initiative.
Representative Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize that everything probably hasn't been thought about as it relates to this concept. Actually, it's interesting. Some of the concerns I have, though, is how do you deal with the fact that there are individuals that are on fixed incomes or because of their geography or because of their family history that they just are constantly going to stay under that threshold and have difficulties for some of the providers in dealing with that fact. You'll end up, in some cases, penalizing some providers who may have a concentration of these individuals. Have you, the department, figured out a way to deal with that?
Mr. Osborne. Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, yes, we have. In fact, that's how we're structuring this. This applies for incentive payment. There's no penalty to anyone. Incentive payment for those providers who do exceed the optimal standard for people, our clients with diabetes, and we'll pay them an additional amount of $100 per client that exceed that optimal standard. And so there is no penalty to that. In fact, what we want to do is that this also applies to our enrollees who are enrolled in managed care. And managed care organizations do have some payment for performance arrangements on their own, but we want to have something on top of that because we do want to measure specifically the improvement of care for our clients. And we don't want to discourage, certainly, any of the medical groups from seeing our clients. And so we think we accomplished that by this provision.
Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Osberg, I have two questions. I presume that optimum will be an evolving term. And I read the language. It was pretty vague, and even the conditions are not listed, and the rewards are not listed. So I presume this is the whole program is evolutionary. But the word optimum would not be a fixed kind of treatment. It would be changing with time as people discover new and greater ideas.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abert, no, there actually is a standard, optimal standard, that's been defined by Minnesota Community Measurement based on ITSE standards, the Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement, which developed health guidelines. They have developed what is optimal, and I don't know, I can't give you offhand those standards, but based on blood sugar level and cholesterol level and there's other standards. If you exceed a certain percentage or certain measurement, then it's optimal care.
Okay.
And so we intend to so that standard may or may not change over time. I don't know. But right now there is a defined standard in terms of optimal care.
Yeah.
Representative Abler.
Well, let me just, I'm trying not to, I'm a supporter working not to become an opponent to this. I just want to do caution you that optimum today will be subpar 20 years from now. And so best you know today is just so don't, and the language is flexible enough, but I hope that whoever the guru of best knowledge is doesn't get a lock on that and nobody can think of something better than that. Because there's a lot of good ideas coming out across the spectrum of healthcare, just to encourage you about that. Now, the bridge is excellent. I thought it showed savings for the employer, and there's no savings shown here but a cost. Is there a corresponding savings that's incorporated into these things, or did you just not dare take that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, right, for the employers, there is a return on investment because of employee absenteeism and productivity that obviously does not apply here. We believe at this point that there will not be a savings gain over the next horizon of the next 2 years, 2.5 years in terms of our biennial budget. After that, I believe there will be, but I think we have to apply this across the board and apply this to other conditions, not just diabetes, before we get that kind of change in the market. But eventually, right, if our clients are healthier because of efforts like this, they will have less expenses. So someday, I hope to come back to this committee with some savings, but at this point, we are not comfortable enough to project that savings over the next biennium.
Thank you.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Osberg and Chairman Bradley, you all know that I strongly support these kinds of efforts and believe there's money to be saved here. But I have to caution you, I had an office full of healthcare providers this afternoon. And while they support these initiatives, they're very concerned that the state's going to come up with standards and paperwork that they have to fill out, and that Medica will have their own set of standards and paperwork to fill out, and Blue Cross Blue Shield will have their standards and paperwork, and Health Partners will do the same, and Medicare from Washington will have a different set, and their hospital accreditation organizations will have another set. So if there's most of us know in this country we spend 33% of healthcare dollar in administration, and most other countries spend about 16%. And we need to be very careful that we don't tie them up with more paperwork and more administration. And if there's one area where I think we could cooperate with both with Doer in purchasing healthcare for their employees and with the Business Healthcare Action Group and the health plans is to coordinate all these sort of pay for performance or quality improvement issues so that the providers aren't stuck with extra paperwork that really doesn't help the system any.
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Strasburg.
Huntley, I agree entirely with that. In fact, that's what we're trying to do, is align ourselves with the major employers to come up with a process that is the same. Now, we're working real closely with the private sector on identifying appropriate guidelines that comes out of Institute for Clinical Systems Improvement. Also, a common way of measuring these things out of the Minnesota Community Measurement. So I think we're all coming together to make sure that we're measuring the right things together, and we're measuring the same way together. The issue is, what do we do on the reward side? Some people have told us that we can't require or align all the payers up to have the same reward system, because that may be antitrust. But we want to align ourselves up with the Business Healthcare Action Group definition of or process of the reward side, and that includes the Registered Excellence Program. So we believe we're trying to do that very thing and minimize the administrative disruption to providers.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just, and I'm sorry if I'm not getting this. The $100 gets paid when?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, gets paid after the fact, obviously, after we measure what the outcome is for our clients. So we're suggesting that this be paid in January in 2007 for 2006 performance.
Representative Thiessen.
Okay. And so it's kind of an annual payment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, that's it. Yes.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, just one question. And then if I look at the numbers, so we're going to be paying, that'll cover about 930 patients next year. And how does that, this is not a forecast program, so once that money is used up, or is this kind of based on the forecast that that's how many people are going to meet this standard?
Mr. Osberg.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if somebody can help me with that. I don't believe we forecasted the payment for performance piece, so I guess what we'd have to do is that if it exceeds that number, we're going to have to prorate the payment.
And then, and one other question.
Representative
Thiessen. It looks like we have about $311,000 to administer the program and $93,000 being spent on the incentives. And I understand your earlier testimony, then the idea there is that investment in the administrative costs is ultimately going to pay off in better health outcomes, and so we'll save the money down the road. It just seems like an odd allocation of costs, but maybe that's...
Mr. Chairman, so we have to start somewhere. We believe that this is going to be critical for our clients and that we'll get better health care. Right now, we're very concerned about the level of care that they receive. In fact, based on the measurement we've seen so far, it's not even close to the general population. So we believe we have to begin somewhere. And so it's an investment in this process over time.
And Mr.
Representative,
so you're anticipating perhaps these incentive payments will go up in the future?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, we like to come back and suggest, certainly, to the legislature where there may be changes and expansion, possibly. I would guess that we'll see how this goes, and we'll go from there.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly going back to what Representative Thiessen was bringing up as it relates to the 311. Is that just startup costs or those ongoing costs that you perceive just to deal with this perceived 930 individuals. So I'm wondering if you come back next year and you want to add more individuals to the incentive, are you going to have the same level of administrative cost?
Mr. Osberg. Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, I'd like to have somebody come down and address the nature of that administrative cost. From our staff. They're flipping a corridor right now to see who gets to come. And the lucky winner is? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Hello, my name is Steve Nelson. I'm with the Healthcare Administration. I believe, could you repeat the question? Was
yes. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, as it relates to the 311, is that startup cost to deal with this pay-per-performance effort? Is the department's going to come back next year and say, we need money for 07, and in addition, we want to deal with heart disease? And really the question is the 311 just the startup administrative cost, or is this going to be the level of cost for the administrative services?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, this is ongoing one FTE and costs for doing the chart reviews, ongoing.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So Representative Thiessen was kind of getting at this unequal balance of costs, or the money that you're looking at is $93,000 on one side and it's $311,000 on the other side. So this is what we're expected to see from the department as it relates to this level of effort or programming, the weighing the costs.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, this isn't including the federal cost of the administration, so you're not seeing that.
Okay.
Representative Walker?
That's fine.
All right, Mr. Nelson, you have a further comment? Or
I guess I should clarify that you're not seeing the federal cost of the program as well.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that would just be double it, right?
Right.
Okay. So it'd be 150. So, but we still, okay, so it's 150 compared to the 311. So it's still that double cost, right?
Well,
we're going to pay out an incentive, 150, and we're going to have it as administrative cost twice that.
Roughly.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nelson, so the what is it we have on NA, 400,000 people? Number of enrollees in MA?
Mr. Nelson?
And Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Huntley, it's 440,000 roughly.
Oh.
Representative Huntley?
Again, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Osberg, so we're having $150,000 worth of administration charged to MA, which has 450,000 enrollees, and Minnesota Care is getting hit 329,000 for about 140,000 enrollees.
Mr. Nelson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we're paying for the administration with health care access fund money.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Nelson, what you're then saying is that you're transferring, in effect, health care access fund money to fund medical assistance.
Mr. Osberg?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, we're not transferring it, we're just using it.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative Huntley.
Yeah, Mr. Osberg, it's too bad you weren't in my office this afternoon to explain that to the physicians and hospital administrators that were in there.
All right, Mr. Osberg, you know, further questions, or do you move on? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, on page 37 is the governor's initiative in developing the Minnesota Pharmacy Access Program. This may look very familiar because this, something like this was enacted a few years ago, but it was sunsetted because of the enactment of Medicare Part D and the drug program. The Pharmacy Access Program will provide discounted prescription drugs to about 13,000 low-income people in Minnesota who do not have prescription drug coverage. MPAT is what we're calling it, would provide discounts on prescriptions from participating pharmacies equal to what the state pays for medical assistance in other state health care programs. To further reduce prices for these people, DHS would negotiate Medicaid-level rebates with pharmaceutical manufacturers, and the savings would be passed on to program participants. We are, of course, have confidence that pharmacies and drug companies will participate in this effort. The program would be available to people earning up to 300% of poverty, which is about $28,700 a year for one person, who are not enrolled in state health care programs or entitled to Medicare Part D drug benefits. So this does not address anybody who opts not to participate in Medicare Part D. It addresses those people who don't have drug coverage otherwise, which is that number is growing, unfortunately. So program participants could save 50% or more on certain generics based on how we price generics through our what we call our maximum allowable cost effort. And up to possibly 30% when rebates are earned for this program on drug or brand drugs. It would be effective July 1st, 2007, to allow us the time to secure those rebate agreements. And we certainly, however, feel that our Canadian website program needs to continue and should continue. We believe that's a valuable service to people in the state as well. This has not replaced that, certainly, so we believe that this program plus the Canadian website option is still very viable and safe and reliable site for Minnesotans.
Any questions, members? Representative Abler.
Doesn't the world end if we do this kind of stuff? Is this going to be controversial to a few people in an audience that attends these meetings, or is this all worked out with pharmaceutical companies and they're happy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, participation is voluntary by pharmacies and by drug companies. There's efforts throughout the country to develop these what's called state pharmaceutical assistance programs. And we're confident that the drug companies will participate and will see the benefit of doing this. We also, of course, are in the process of and continue to be process of helping people who are eligible for drug-sponsored assistance programs, too. We have that arrangement in place. So we don't anticipate, hopefully, any changes to that effort either. Drug companies have stepped up and provided that assistance to people who don't have coverage. So we're trying to do whatever we can to help people who don't have pharmaceutical insurance. The last budget page, Mr. Chairman, is on page 40. It's Medicare Part D implementation, enrollment, and access. I guess I don't have to tell you about the challenge around that. And it's good to see that more Minnesotans have signed up this past month for the benefit. But it continues to be a complicated situation for a lot of our beneficiaries. There's roughly 700,000 Medicare beneficiaries in this state. 100,000 of them are dually eligible. They're eligible for both Medicare and Medicaid. But we feel our obligation goes beyond those 100,000 people. We need to step up and serve best we can Medicare beneficiaries in the state. The proposals include resources to provide assistance through the Minnesota Linkage Line and other supports, including the area agencies on aging, who are on the front line of this effort. DHS has also needs to increase administrative coordination with federal agencies to ensure that dual eligibles do not have gaps in drug coverage and that eligible beneficiaries receive the Medicare low-income subsidy. Of course, as you know, you enacted, and the governor signed the pair of last resort provision, first week of session, and that will bring funding through April 15th. Now, at this point, CMS has not given an indication whether or not there's going to be any further reimbursement of those costs. Fortunately, those issues are starting to work out, but there continue to be complications, especially for our dual eligibles and low-income Medicare beneficiaries. Now, this proposal relates also to our eligibility provisions. The Social Security Administration takes the lead on determining low-income subsidy for Medicare Part D. However, the law, federal law, requires that Medicaid agencies may have to be involved in this. To date, we have not received any applications, but there are reports that the Social Security Administration is backlogged, and we have concerns that they and CMS would look to the state Medicaid agencies for assistance. And state law prohibits medical assistance and GMC from paying for prescription drugs that are covered by Medicare. Plus, the state, under federal law, is required to provide a 10-day notice to medical assistance enrollees of a reduction in their MA prescription drug benefit. Approximately 400 of our clients move into a dual eligible status. They go from Medicaid only to Medicare and Medicaid, 400 a month. And so they need assistance to think through and process this benefit, Medicare Part D benefit. In retrospect, I think it would have been best if Congress would not have moved those people out of Medicaid and put them into Medicare, but that is not being debated. So we have three FTEs to handle the eligibility and enrollment work. On the terms of linkage line issues, the government recommendation last year to fund this assistance program was not adopted in 2005. So we found some one-time federal grant money and some reallocated administrative money to support area agencies on aging linkage lines. But this money will be depleted in April of this year. And we expect greater call volume more than ever, and this will continue over a long period of time, not just during the interim here. Because of expected changes in drug formularies and participating drug plans and employer retiree coverage, beneficiaries will continue to need extensive assistance to make appropriate choices. Again, all Medicare beneficiaries. Beneficiaries will also need assistance in switching drug plans and navigating the appeals process for drugs that are not covered. Medicare Part D work has taken over, in essence, the work of the linkage line, assisting seniors and their caregivers with community-based options to stay independent. The proposal includes 31 FTEs to continue this level of support that we started in the fall at seven call centers and satellite sites throughout the state to help people. Again, we believe, even though this is the federal government responsibility, and we agree with that, we've had to step up, and we need to continue to make that assistance available on an ongoing basis in order to help not only our dual eligibles, but all Medicare beneficiaries to enroll in the right plan. Mr. Chairman, that completes our budget pages.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Osberg, how many FTEs did you say are going to support this program?
We're in need of 31 FTEs. Ongoing basis.
Krista. Welcome. Please state your name.
Krista Boston. I'm a manager with the Department of Human Services and the Minnesota Board on Aging. Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, this would fund 31 FTEs that would be positioned out at, they would be employees of the area agencies on aging. So these would be grant funds that would fund those positions to be available out in the community. They would do a number of functions, including being available at call centers to answer the calls, as well as being on site to help with face-to-face enrollment and do home visits.
Thank
you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Osberg. Again, I see in 2007, $1,637,000 of health care access money being used to support this program, and currently Minnesota Care specifically prevents anybody that's eligible from Medicare from being on Minnesota Care. So why are we again taking Minnesota Care money to fund the Medicare program?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, we believe that certainly that this issue is an access issue and that the Health Care Access Fund is the appropriate source for supporting this kind of effort. you're right, this does not directly impact benefits or eligibility in terms of Minnesota Care itself, but Healthcare Access Fund currently supports other efforts beyond Minnesota Care. And so what we believe is that this is a very appropriate funding source for this kind of effort to increase access, improve access for people who are on Medicare.
Any further questions here, members? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you. Just want to go back to the Minnesota Pharmacy Access Program for a minute. Mm-hmm. Is that going to hold the discount will take place with the person paying this will be the state reimbursing the... How does that work? I mean, how does it affect the pharmacist? And can you just explain it a little in more detail? I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, what will happen is that an enrollee will go to the pharmacy and get the Medicaid-level pricing. Now, that will reflect the AWP minus 12% plus $3.65 cents for dispensing, plus the rebates that we have garnered before the effective date of the program. So we will know that in advance as to what that price is. And so what will happen is that the enrollee will pay that price. And we will then make the pharmacy whole in terms of the rebate piece. Otherwise, the pharmacy, in essence, right, is selling the drug at AWP minus 12% plus $3.65.
And that's what, and Mr. Representative, so that's what the pharmacy will get.
That's what the pharmacy will get.
And the 15% is between you and the pharmaceutical company.
The rebates are between us and the pharmaceutical company. That's right, Mr. Chairman.
See no further questions. Representative Bradley, back to you.
Well, Mr. Chair, I know the hour's late, but there may be some people here that would like an opportunity to perhaps give brief testimony on any of the components of the bill. We've not had a chance. Well, we did it on individual pieces, but on the remaining pieces that we've not paused and offered an opportunity, it might be in order to offer that.
Any members of the audience wish to testify?
I think they can look at the look in the eyes.
We have one taker.
Why does it have to be me?
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Beth Hartwick with Minnesota Business Partnership. We're handing out a letter, so I will be very brief. There's a couple of sections that I wanted to talk about. Article 1, Section 3, and Health Information Technology Grants. You know, these grants will help collaborative community projects do what is being done in the market right now, but they just need a little push and a little assistance, so we would support that. Article 2, Section 2, Pay for Performance. Many business partnership members are also participating in BTE, and we would love to have the state partner with us. These proposals are consistent with our agenda, as well as the Smart Buy Alliance goals, and we would encourage you to support them.
Thank you. Good evening. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and proceed.
Good evening, Mr. Chair members. My name is Heidi Holsey. I'm Advocacy Director for AARP Minnesota. And I will be brief. You do have testimony that a volunteer who normally would testify. It is in your packet, but I will cut that a little bit short and just let you know that as far as Representative Bradley's bill in the governor's budget, we do support the pharmacy assistance program as well as the additional funding for the linkage line. We feel that both of those are very good proposals, and that is all I will say tonight.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anybody else wish to testify? Oh, here we go.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Erin Sexton with the Minnesota Chamber, and hopefully you have a letter in your packet expressing our support for some of the quality measures, so I'm not going to hit on that. But I just also want to briefly mention some support for the MSHA relief that's in this bill. Although it is only $10 million, we would love to see more relief, if not getting rid of the MSHA assessment altogether. We think any relief is going to help our small and medium businesses that are unfairly affected by this assessment. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Anybody else? doesn't have notes, so this will be quick, I bet. Welcome to the committee.
Please thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bob Vanosik, and I'm here representing the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, and just want to express concerns about the section of the bill that deals with the Pharmacy Access Program. Even though it has been stated, too, that it is a voluntary program, it does contain price control language that we're concerned about. We think that greater emphasis should be put on the patient assistance programs that were referenced earlier. In the past 10 months in Minnesota, those programs have served over 13,000 Minnesotans and have had access to approximately 1,200 medicines. And it's a program that provides not only heavily discounted prices for those drugs, but in many cases, those drugs are obtained free of charge.
Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else wish to testify? See nobody else. Representative Bradley, do you have any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the patience of the committee in reviewing. I think we've had a good review and good discussions along the way. Questions have been raised that we will need to attend to. The action tonight will be simply to lay over House File 3697 as amended for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Representative Bradley. Seeing no further questions, or Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Bradley, do you have an idea when we're going to schedule the actually doing the finance bill?
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, no, I really don't. Obviously, we've got to go through the budget process, budget that we worked a little bit today and didn't quite get done, so we'll have to come back and visit that. And it takes a while, I don't know how long, but then the next thing we'll have to do is figure targets. That's at least, I think, a couple of weeks away probably before I can put something together as a start point. So I think we're somewhere in that range, probably optimistic.
Any further discussion, members? Seeing no further discussion, the chair will lay over House File 3697 as amended for possible inclusion in the Health Human Service Finance Omnibus Bill. Thank you, Representative Bradley. Seeing no further business, this meeting is now adjourned.